Welcome everyone to Johannesburg, to our face-to-face meeting, the ZCWG on Accountability Workstream 2. It's been quite a ride in some of the subgroups since our last meeting in Copenhagen, and I think we're gonna have a good meeting today. We have some important issues to speak about, of course, and some deliberations and first readings from some of the subgroups as well. I'd like to begin by reminding you to please state your name when you speak. This is very useful for transcript purposes, but also for the people that is connecting with us remotely. Please do remember to state your name before speaking. Please speak at a moderate pace so that the interpreters are able to follow if we have an interpretation. I don't think we have an interpretation today, but yes. Also, may I remind you of the expected standards of behavior. I think that everyone is familiar with those already, and if you don't, if you are new to the standards of behavior, please feel free to ask staff for references on the standards of behavior. We also have, as I said, a packed agenda for today. We'll be going through the Workstream 2 extension. We're gonna receive an update on status and budget. We're gonna also receive an update from IRP-IoT, an update on CEP. Then we're gonna break for 15 minutes, and when we come back from the break, we're gonna go through SO and AC accountability update on public consultation. We're gonna go then with transparency. We're gonna get a status update on that and on the public consultation. Then we're gonna have lunch, and of course, staff will be able to guide us to where lunch will be taking place. Then we're gonna have a presentation by the Ombudsman subgroup, and I mean, the external review recommendations. And after that, we're gonna review the staff accountability recommendations. We're gonna the first reading on that document. Then we're gonna break again, and then we're gonna speak about the star issue of the day, which is jurisdiction. And I hope that we have a thorough and constructive discussion on jurisdiction. We have been following the discussion on the list. We are aware of the different issues that have been raised, and we will address all of the issues and all of the questions that have been raised in the mailing list. After that, we're gonna do a quick wrap-up, and then we'll go for beers. So, let's do this fast so we can get to the beers as fast as we can. Okay, so, I'd like to turn now to Bernie for some administration. Am I forgetting anything? Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Yes, the roll call will be as usual, those who are on the Adobe Connect room, and if there is anyone on the line that is not in the Adobe Connect room, please do state your name now so we can add you to the roll call. And let's continue to use the Adobe Connect room to handle the queue for those present in the room, because it's easier to handle it that way. We get we get into problems with, we have to handle the queue within the room and also within the AC room. So if you can please log into the AC room, that will help us better handle the queue whenever someone raises their hand. And I see Cavus is just raising his hand. So, Cavus, do you have the floor?
Yes. Good morning to you and to everybody. If I am properly heard, you are talking of the extension. Am I right? We would like to know what is the reason of the extension. Why the work were not done in the time that was expected? Was a matter of a lack of supervision, a matter of inappropriate course of action taken when following the matters? And at least we should know the reasons. Written form by the co-chair getting information from their rapporteur providing reasons for extension. And by the way, as I mentioned in some other meeting, every individual has special vocal arrangements, and sometimes in particular when they are speaking on the Adobe connection, they may speak in view of some other people loudly, and it should not be interpreted that that person speaks loudly as being interpreted as shouting. I was very much disappointed by some of the colleagues mentioning that, and I explained that several times. Not all the lines have the same quality. Sometimes remotely speaking is difficult. And when we don't hear very well, we thought that we are not heard also well. So that is the situation. And this is something that we don't expect to be repeated. So we need to have clear indication by the co-chair, a paper giving the reason for extension. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kavuz. We will speak about that in our next item. We're going to speak about extension and the reasons why this is happening. And, of course, I also remind you to update your statement of interest if you haven't done so. And we, as usual, have a timer, and we are willing to use it, but it's best if we don't use it. So try to keep your intervention short. We have a two-minute timer if it's needed. So next I would like to give the floor to Bernie for some administration details. So, Bernie.
Thank you, Leon. Good morning, everyone. Okay, very quickly, we've gone through the agenda. That's clear. Probably the big news of the day is Workstream 2 extension budget was approved yesterday by the board, so that's a done thing. We'll be going over that, and to answer Caboose's question, I think the co-chairs will be answering that. Could I have the next slide, please, so we can talk to the action items from the last meeting? All right, here we go. So it was about a month ago that we met last time, since our last scheduled meeting was canceled. So it's from 24 May. The decisions at that point were the modified reporting schedule, which was approved, and the approval process for Workstream 2 was approved for first reading. Following that, we did ask people to confirm the second reading via email, which was done. And the approval of the second reading and therefore the final approval of the Workstream 2 approval recommendations document has been completed. Under the action items, we had staff to draft a letter of appreciation for Matthew Weil. That was done and circulated, I believe. And to present approval process for Workstream 2 recommendations document for second reading at next plenary. I think I just covered that given we canceled the last plenary, we asked for approval via the email list, and this was completed. So that completes the action items, if you will. The last note is the master calendar is now open for July and August scheduling of subgroup meetings. No one has really scheduled anything for July and August, and now that we have the confirmation that the Workstream 2 budget for fiscal year 18 has been approved, we'll be glad to take reservations for those time slots. It's the same procedure as always. It's the same location for the calendar. It's the same time slots. So if you have the time and the inclination to request some slots be reserved for your subgroup, please do so. That's it for me. Back to you, Leon.
Thank you very much, Bernie. This is Leon Sanchez. And I just want to convey a message to the group from Matthew Bale. He received the letter from the group. He was very happy to receive it, and he liked it a lot. And he asked us to say thank you to the group on his behalf. So the message is now delivered, and now we are also having a brand new coacher on his first face-to-face meeting, which is Jordan Carter, and I'd like to welcome Jordan officially as a coacher in a face-to-face meeting. We all know Jordan quite well with his role as a rapporteur in many subgroups, and we are very lucky to have him now as coacher appointed by the CCNSO. So now I would like to turn to Thomas for the next agenda item.
Thanks very much, Leon, and good morning to all of you, both in the room as well as those who are joining us remotely. I know it's going to be a challenge for the remote participants to follow so many hours on the Adobe Room, but that's much appreciated. It's good to have you there. Before we move to the WS2 extension discussion, let me just add a little bit of color to what Leon was saying with respect to the letter that was sent to Mathieu. I'm not sure whether all of you had an opportunity to read it, but we did something which I think is sort of characteristic to this group, because we tried to do something special for a dear-hearted special co-chair. You will all remember that Mathieu used to say every good project starts with a spreadsheet, and so in the last paragraph of the letter, we said, well, your motto is every good project starts with a spreadsheet, and thereby our farewell gift for you is a spreadsheet, which we called nextnewproject.xls, and we added an empty spreadsheet to the letter, and that's something that he particularly liked and appreciated. Now, back to substance for today. We've heard already from Bernie that the WS2 budget has been approved, and that is an ideal opportunity for me to thank Becky Nash to join us today and say a few words in a couple of seconds. I want to also seize the opportunity to respond to Kavus's question, which I think is particularly important to put on record for those who are not in the room, because I guess everyone here knows a little bit about why we are going into overtime, but the rest of the community should also be appraised of why we are still working on this. And I guess that the answer to us taking more time than originally anticipated is multifold. One is that the sub-teams started slower than we expected. So I guess that part of that is exhaustion and fatigue after we had done this perforce ride to finish our Workstream 1 work. So it was only a few weeks, if not months, for some groups until they were set up and really started substantive work. I guess the second point is that on some of the sub-teams aspects that are under consideration, the discussions turned out to be more complex than originally anticipated. So the groups needed a little bit longer to give themselves an agenda, work plan, and start substantive work. And then with this delay in place, we did a calculation with public comment periods and the approval process and counted backwards as to what a reasonable time frame we would need would be. And that is basically the time frame that we've discussed with the CCWG plenary on a couple of occasions during plenary meetings. And if all works well, we're going to be done with this one extension. And I should also say that we should try to make sure, and I'm sure that we will get back to this topic in the course of our discussions, maybe today even, that we will actually be ready by then. Because what we don't get done by then is uncertain. You know, it is very uncertain whether we're going to get another extension, whether we are actually going to get additional funds, additional staff support, and all that. So we should make sure that we deliver on time, because I think it's highly likely that the chartering organizations will say, well, you had your time, you didn't make enough out of it, and therefore we're going to stop the CCWG accountability effort here, and all other accountability enhancements or improvements or new projects should be started through the periodic reviews that we have in our bylaws. So if we want to control changes, this is more or less a year that we have at our fingertips in order to get that done. And with that, I would like to hand over to Bernie and Becky to give us a little bit more information about the budget situation, which was thankfully accepted. And I should also say that in terms of chartering organizations, the only missing chartering organization to grant approval for the extension is the CCNSO, but from what we understand from the CCNSO's discussions is that this should more or less be only a formality. So, Bernie, over to you.
Thank you, Thomas. We're not the big news has been given. I think the co-chairs have answered the question. We're fortunate enough to have Becky Nash from ICANN Finance here. And at this point, we will walk through, or she will walk through, in summary fashion, the budget that has been allocated for this extension. Thank you. Becky?
Thank you, Bernie, and thank you to the co-chairs. My name is Becky Nash, and I'm from ICANN Finance, and I'm part of what we call the PCST, Project Cost Support Team, and we will talk through a summary of the Workstream 2 FY18 budget, which is being loaded at this time on the Adobe. Okay, as Bernie and the co-chairs have indicated, yesterday the FY18 extension to Workstream 2 was approved by the ICANN board, and we do have displayed in Adobe a summary of the budget. I'm not sure if it is displayed, if we could make it a little bit smaller for all the columns to be shown. That would be great. So while the figures are being resized on the screen, just in summary, the budget was prepared by the PCST team at the direction of the co-chairs. The PCST team received information from the co-chairs on all of the activities and timing of activities that were expected to occur and be extended into FY18. And we then developed a bottoms-up detailed budget by activity and by cost type. So based on the screen, the total amount of the FY18 budget for Workstream 2, as you can see at the bottom right-hand corner, is rounded to $3.1 million. Just staying in that total column on the right-hand side, we can see that the total costs for the cross-community working group is $650,000, and the total cost supporting the endeavor from ICANN staff support is $2.4 million. Again, these activities were all based on a bottoms-up detail by activity. And if I could just direct you to the top portion where we have the total cost for the CCWG support. Going across the columns on the top, you can see that we have the travels and meeting support, which is the cost to support the face-to-face meetings that take place, such as this one here at Johannesburg. Additional costs driven by the CCWG are legal services. Those would be costs related to any kind of advice or document review that would be required. And then there are other professional services related to the support for all of the reports and report writing and the final deliverables to be delivered. And that is based on the accountability workstream 2 is the larger portion of the budget. We do see that we do have work related still to IRP phase 2 that has been carried over into FY18 as well. Then looking at the middle section, we call it ICANN support, which is all of the activities related to supporting the CCWG Workstream 2 activities. And there we have our staff support, travels and meetings. Going across the columns, the next column is the language services support, which is very important for this endeavor. Again, we do have legal services, should there be need to review documents. And finally, the other professional services are related to supporting either consultancy or comms, which would be communications, and the finalization of the deliverables and all of the reports. And that gives a breakdown then of the two main components for the budget, which would be split into the CCWG portion and then the ICANN support portion. And at the very bottom of the schedule, we have the sum of the two, which gives you the total amounts by cost category for all of the activities expected for this extension. And again, arriving at the total annualized budget of $3.1 million, which, as we announced, has already been approved for the FY18 budget. And that's all that I have for an overview. Bernie, did you want to say anything more?
Thank you. I see Xavier's hand up. Xavier.
Thank you. Just a quick comment to add that this amount of $3.1 million has been proposed to be funded from the reserve fund of ICANN, not from its ongoing operations. And this is something that was originally planned, as you remember, for the FY17 budget. But the funding of that amount for FY18 is also suggested to be from the reserve fund.
Thank you, Xavier. Just in closing on this, the PCSD, will continue applying the same oversight mechanisms to this, generating the reports and monitoring this. There is no change there. It's just an extension, and I think part of the renewal or the extension here is a recognition that there was some serious oversight of our budget, that we handled our money well, and that we were serious with this. And therefore, that part of the experiment worked out well, and we will continue with it. Now, we're talking about a one-year extension. It doesn't mean, as we did with the previous point, doesn't mean we have to use all the time or all the money. If we can get done earlier, please, let's work on it. And I think we're well on way to do that with a number of projects. We'll be glad to take questions if there are any.
And again, if you do want to make yourself heard, please use the Adobe Connect functionality to raise your hand.
Seeing none,
so
I'll
Becky
hand it
and Bernie, it looks like you've done a fantastic job informing the groups, so they don't have any questions. In summary, I think we should all take away three messages from this for the coming week. One is, we've obviously done a good job in managing our finances, and as you will recall, this is the first community-driven effort ever that was given its own budget. So I think this test drive of a new form of collaboration has been successful so far. I'm extremely thankful to Xavier and his team to having tested this with us, and I'm happy that we managed to deliver, as hopefully as expected. And this might be a precedent for other initiatives to come, and I think that's great to see this new form of collaboration between ICANN, the organization, and the community. So the second thing is, because I'm getting asked this question over and over again, is how can it work that you don't need extra money if you're working for longer? And in summary, if you want to respond to that, is yes, we underspend from our own budget, and therefore we're just spreading what we asked for originally to this additional year, and we are not asking for additional money for the for staff support and other costs, but that's actually taken from the originally allocated budget. So we are on budget. And third thing, and I'm happy to repeat myself here, let's make sure that we get the job done in a maximum of the additional 12 months so that we don't have to ask, go back to the chartering organizations and ICANN to ask for even more money. And that might be an encouragement and re-energize the community a little bit to join our discussions and help us deliver on time. Thanks so much, Becky. Thanks so much, Bernie. Thanks so much, Xavier, for joining us today on this important subject. And I'd now like to hand over to Jordan to chair the next agenda item.
Great. Thanks, Thomas. Good morning, everyone. The next topic on our agenda is an update on the IRP implementation oversight team from David. And my job, difficult as it is in my first intervention as a co-chair, is to hand over to David. It's all yours.
Thank you, Jordan. Excuse me. Good morning, everyone. My name is David McCauley. I'm the lead of the Independent Review Process Implementation Oversight Team. I'm actually the second lead. Becky Burr was our lead until she stepped onto the ICANN board and did much of the foundational work for the IRP team, and for which we're grateful and is allowing us to make further progress. Could I go to the next slide, please? Let me just mention that what my presentation will be about today is really a status, a reminder, if you will, of what the IRP does and does not do, and then give an update as to the progress that we're making on certain pillars that are the constituent parts of the new IRP, which is an important accountability mechanism in the new accountability regimen that we did in the transition. The IRP, the independent review process, is found in bylaw section 4.3. It's quite an extensive section, but in that section you basically get all of the IRP process, and it's a good section to be familiar with and to bookmark, if you will. The new IRP process came into effect with the new bylaws on October 1st of last year, and so that new standard, that new IRP process, the standard at least, is in effect as we speak. And so in the further in the rest of my comments, what I intend to do is talk about the purpose of the IRP. It's really a review. Talk about the three main pillars that I think are the main part of the IRP process, and then do a few miscellaneous notes at the end. Next slide, please. The purpose of the IRP, you can read, it's all in section 4.3A of the bylaws, but importantly, it is the topmost internal accountability mechanism for ensuring that ICANN does not exceed its mission and it does and that it does comply with its articles and bylaws. The IRP will let the community, including the empowered community, bring claims. Individuals, registrants, can bring claims to enforce compliance with ICANN's articles and bylaws. The IRP also goes beyond that to ensure contract compliance with the IANA naming functions contract. It provides a vehicle for IANA customers to make claims for resolution of PTI service complaints. And involved in all of the IRP, the new IRP, is the element or the idea of precedent, setting a precedent going forward. So this will be a precedential-based arbitration body, if you will. Next slide, please. One other important idea that I'd like to mention from this slide is that this will lead to binding final resolutions, binding in the sense that ICANN will be bound to comply with the results of the IRP or enforcement measures could be taken. The IRP process, as I said, is the senior-most internal ICANN vehicle for resolving disputes, and it is meant to be a valid, robust alternative to civil litigation, which is civil litigation, as we all know, can be extraordinarily expensive. The IRP process can be expensive, but obviously the hope and the intent is that it be not as expensive as civil litigation. Next slide, please. What I refer to as the main pillars of the new IRP are three. One is the new standard of review. That's done and that's dusted. It's in place as of the effective date of the new bylaws. Two is the standing panel, which I'll talk about in just a minute. And three is the updated supplementary rules of procedure. So the first bit on that slide is done and in place. The next two constituent pillars of the IRP are in the process of being developed. Next slide, please. The new standard is important because it addresses certain kinds of cases that can be brought, cases that claims that ICANN, and ICANN is defined as being the board or individual directors and officers or staff of the corporation. The standard is, did they act or did they fail to act in a manner that exceeded the bylaws and the articles? And that includes exceeding the scope of their mission. It includes challenges to the results of process-specific expert panels. These are the panels that came into effect in the new GTLD program. We know them as string similarity panels, legal objections, community objection panels. Those kinds of panels are now appealable to IRP. Now, the decision of the panel isn't fully reviewable. Remember, the IRP itself is bounded by a review of whether ICANN's action, perhaps in response to one of these panel decisions, violated the bylaws or the articles. And so that'll be the standard of the appeal for these kind of appeals from the lower panels. Next slide, please. The bylaws specifically mention that ICANN's response to a request for documentary disclosure under the DIDP policy, if a claimant believes that ICANN's response violated the articles or bylaws, they specifically have the right to bring that kind of a case to the IRP. Empowered community can bring cases. And then the IRP can also review claims that that ICANN did not enforce its contractual rights with respect to the naming functions contract, and also PTI service complaints can be brought to IRP. Next slide, please. Specifically excluded from the scope of the IRP are empowered community challenges to the outcome of a policy development process. If the supporting organization that was engaged in building that PDP does not consent to the IRP. Also excluded, CCTLD delegations and redelegations can't be reviewed at IRP. Numbering resources and protocol parameters issues likewise cannot be. Slow down. Sorry. I'm sorry. I'm trying to keep this within 15 minutes. My apologies. Next slide, please.
We're doing fine in terms of time. If you take it 2-3 minutes longer,
okay.
That's no problem.
Thank you. One other part that I wanted to stress in this scope nature of review is the standard is expressly stated as being an objective de novo standard. So let me just mention in the context of what I was just speaking about, that is the results of decisions of expert panels. Those kinds of appeals there will not be any presumption that the panel below was correct. Every appeal that goes to IRP will be an appeal de novo, an objective analysis of whether, in fact, whatever ICANN did on its own or in response to a panel decision or a PDP process, whether ICANN's action along those lines either did or did not violate the articles or the bylaws. Next slide, please. The next element or pillar of the new IRP process is the standing panel. There will be, under the bylaws, a standing panel of at least 7 members to draw from. And what I mean to draw from, any one case will be heard before three panel members. One member will be chosen by the claimant, one member will be chosen by ICANN, and those two will choose the third member. There will be a body of standing panel members, at least 7. There's no cap on the number. From which these will be drawn. There will be a secretariat to support this. There currently is the International Center for Dispute Resolution. That'll continue unless a new organization is found. Another important part of putting together the standing panel is the expression of interest. That is a solicitation by ICANN to the world, to people that are potential panelists, to come and apply to ICANN to be a member of the standing panel. the expression of interest element is something that the bylaws give to ICANN to do. This is ICANN's role to put this together. The IRP implementation oversight team has volunteered to assist in this respect. We have assisted so far. We've helped in the drafting of the expression of interest document. And ICANN Legal and ICANN Policy are currently working on this to get it issued. Hopefully this will be issued soon. And I'll speak about it in conjunction with another part of the IRP in just a few moments. There is another role, and this is one that will be played under the bylaws, by ICANN in conjunction with the SOs and the ACs. And that role is to look at the applications that come in from people that would like to be panelists, to vet them, go through them, organize them, and figure out which ones should be at the top of the pile for interviewing and further consideration. This is something that I spoke about in Copenhagen. It's something that the SOs and the ACs need to become aware of, become comfortable with. Again, the IOT, the Implementation Oversight Team, has volunteered to help in this respect, but the bylaws do give the responsibility here to both ICANN and the SOs and the ACs. To everybody in the room that is a member of an SO or an AC, I encourage you to mention this within your SO or your AC, to become familiar with this part of the bylaws, chat with me or other members of the IOT to become familiar with it, and to help this process along, to help ICANN Legal and Policy, which is now in the process of forming some kind of training or assistance to help SOs and ACs fulfill this function. This, in conjunction with the vetting process that I spoke of, the expression of interest that I spoke about just a minute ago, is really critical to getting this process underway and off the ground. Once these two things are done and this expression document is issued, hopefully in short order, then there will be receipt of applications from potential panelists. The nominations of people to serve on the panel is the sole function of SOs and ACs. Now, there will be a review or a confirmation of these nominations by the board, but the board cannot unreasonably withhold its confirmation. The nomination itself will be specifically left to SOs and ACs. It's their role alone, and again, they will need assistance in being able to fulfill this function. ICANN Legal and Policy are currently working on ways to help organize that. We've offered our assistance, and I know the process is moving forward. I encourage you, members of SOs and ACs, when you are interacting with members from ICANN Legal or ICANN Policy, let them know that you're aware of this, very interested in this. This is an important part of getting the IRP process up and off the ground, the new IRP process up and off the ground. Next slide, please. This is some details about what the panel will do. They will have 5-year terms. They cannot be recalled except for specific serious issues. There are provisions that panelists must be independent of ICANN and independent of SOs and ACs. I've mentioned the three panels, three members will hear cases. Appeals will be possible of an IRP decision to the full standing panel. And there is a target in mind for IRP panelists to issue decisions within 6 months. I'll say something else about this in just a few moments. Next slide, please. The rules of procedure are the third constituent part. So there's the new standard, there's the standing panel, and the rules are the third important thing to get this IRP up and running. And our implementation team is right now working on the rules, and it's taken some time, but they are complex. There has been a lot of discussion around them, and we are really hitting our stride and doing well, I think. The first draft of the updated rules was put out for public comment. We got a number of good, thoughtful public comments, and we're working our way through it. I simply note there are four issues, among others, that have garnered the greater amount of our work so far, and those are the time within which a claimant must file a claim at IRP or else lose it. Malcolm Huddy is handling that part of the discussion for us, is leading it, I should say. Retroactivity of the new standard and retroactivity of the rules themselves are being discussed. They were brought up in public comments. Joinder of interested parties has been brought up. For instance, I mentioned the expert panels below. Well, a claimant bringing a case relative to an expert panel below will, in most cases, be the loser. And so the winner of the case below may be an interested party at the IRP. I would think that they would be. And so we're working on ways that they could or could not be joined, depending on the nature of the case. And then challenges to consensus policies. Those are the ones that have most recently gotten the greater part of our attention. Next slide, please. Some miscellaneous notes about the IRP. I mentioned there was a target of 6 months from the time of a claim to a decision. Well, there is a cooperative engagement process under the IRP bylaw. You can see it there, section 4.3E. The cooperative engagement process is something under the IRP that the parties are encouraged to do. It's non-mandatory, but it is a formalized way to say, look, try and negotiate a settlement of this dispute. There is a cost if you don't participate. For instance, if someone does not participate in the CEP and loses the case, they may find themselves responsible for ICANN's legal fees. So that's an important bylaw to look at. Another miscellaneous point, and this is somewhat like CEP but a little different, is once the parties are engaged in CEP, there'll be conciliation efforts to try and narrow the issues. And so if someone brings a claim with 3 or 4 points, there'll be an attempt to try and narrow it down, whittle it down to what's the nub of the case. Let's see if we can get it down to 1 or 2 points. With respect to the CEP that I mentioned just a moment ago, that can clearly have an effect on the target of 6 months to completion. Ed Morris is leading a subgroup on CEP, and we are going to try and work together to see what we can do to remain mindful of the target of 6 months, but to also recognize in our IRP rules the fact that CEP will be taking place. That's all I can say about it right now, but the two groups need to mesh, coordinate, and make sure that these two are addressed soundly with both thoughts in mind. I have a bullet on this page that says the IRP IoT status needs to be addressed. We will probably make a comment on this in our report. And that is, we, the IoT, began life as part of the CCWG for accountability, very happily. But now we are a recognized part of, we are recognized as an independent entity now by bylaw 4.3. It talks about the team, and it looks, it's not the clearest part of the bylaw, but it looks like this team will continue as rules are developed in the future. This will be an ongoing process. And so we will look to make comments about how the team should be handled, staffed, should it be dormant at times, those kinds of things. And then the final miscellaneous point I put on the slides is there is a bylaw provision that encourages ICANN to come up with some financial way to help people make IRP claims who are otherwise financially sort of unable to do so. It's just, as you see it there, ICANN shall seek. It's not the most mandatory of things, but there is a way to try and encourage ICANN to make this a mechanism that's open to all, and that the financial wherewithal would not be a barrier. By and large, that's where we are. We are making progress. We're hitting our stride on the rules. We will probably go out for a second public comment. We haven't decided that yet. We've not made any final decisions on the rules, but we're getting very close through second reading now on some of our treatment of the rules. And so we're doing well. I want to thank the members of the IOP, of the IoT team. I want to thank Bernie and his team on the staff that are helping us immensely, and the leadership of the CCWG. We have everything we need to press on and do good work, and I hope we do, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thanks very much for that, David. While you're sort of working out if there are any questions, and I see a hand up, I'll just refer to a question that Keith Drazak asked in the chat channel, which was, whether we can get an update from ICANN Legal or Policy on the status of the IOP Standing Panel Expression of Interest document and communication. And Keith's question is, when will it be issued? David, I don't know if you want to make any response to that, but I don't think it's—I think it's a reasonable thing for us to ask ICANN to provide a formal update on.
Thanks, Keith. I don't think there's anyone here from ICANN Legal or Policy staff that could comment, but I do. It is important that this get done. I know it's in train in the background, and my hope is that it will be that it can be expedited. And that's why I encourage people here who are participating in SOs and ACs to become aware. Socialize this within your groups. Mention it when you have contact with ICANN Policy and Legal. But other than that, I really can't say with any specificity when this will happen, other than our hope within the IoT team is that this will happen soon, as soon as possible. And we are encouraging good efforts along these lines. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, David. I'll turn to the queue in the Adobe room. The first is Fiona Asonga. Fiona, fire away.
Thank you very much. Fiona Asonga speaking, for the record. A quick one on the independent review panel selection. If we are talking about wanting a group that will be independent, would we be able to achieve that independence if the SCs and SOs have to be the ones that do the nomination? Because I remember at one point initially when we began this conversation, we had considered having it an open process where anybody in the world who meets a certain qualification can apply, and they don't have to go through a specific SCs and SOs because of the need for them to be independent of the SCs and SOs that may come to them for arbitration or issues getting resolved. So how do we achieve this if we go through the SCs and SOs?
Thank you, Fiona. Fair question. There are other bits that I haven't mentioned. One of the things that will be required of panelists is a knowledge of the DNS. They have to be familiar with what goes on here in the ICANN community and within the ICANN work. And so one of the consequences of Workstream 1 was trying to balance this, and one of the balancing ways of achieving independence is to give one organization, like the group of SOs and ACs, the power to nominate, and to give ICANN the power to confirm. Both of those have a stake in the game, obviously, and so the notion of independence does come up. It's a legitimate concern, but I would say that because it's within the ICANN community, because the panelists have to be steeped to a certain degree with knowledge of the DNS, and with the knowledge that the bylaws themselves speak to certain parts of independence in 4.3N and I think in 4.3Q, that I think there's a sufficient way to achieve an objective standing panel. Your concern is well stated. It's not unreasonable at all, and we'll see. But if there were going to be a different method, it would require a change to the bylaws, because this is now baked in, and it was discussed, as I recall, in Workstream 1. It's not the easiest thing to solve, but this was the approach that was taken and thought best. Thank you.
Thanks, David. Thanks, Fiona. Just to keep us to time in the session, we'll close the queue after Jorge. And if you've got other questions for David, I'm sure he'll be more than happy to take them by email or just come to chat with him after the session. Olga, you're next.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Jordan. Thank you, David. Very clear explanation. You said that nominations to serve on the panel are the sole option of the SOs and ACs. How much time will the SOs and ACs have to make the selection, the call for applications? And if you could give us an idea of when this would happen in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Olga. Good questions. There is no time limit for SOs and ACs to do it. In order for the new IRP to be fully staffed and functional, this is an important constituent part, and that's why I refer to it as one of the pillars, the standing panel. And so I would encourage SOs and ACs to do their best to organize both within and among themselves to become conversant with this, and then when they discuss with ICANN legal and policy to let it be known that this is something that you're looking for and looking to. And again, recall that the IoT is willing to assist in this respect. We don't have a bylaw or role in this, but we are now becoming well-versed in the new IRP. And so we will have some skills that we could probably add to this if there is a request along those lines. And so there's no time limit, but there is probably, I would think, an interest within the ICANN community to move this forward as quickly as reasonably possible. And so hopefully that will address your question as best I can. Thank you.
Thanks, David. Nils Tenove.
Thank you very much for this important work and also for the regular updates that we get every time. It's very informative. Thank you very much. You mentioned shortly that there could be specific conditions under which the ICANN legal fees need to be covered by one of the parties in an IRP process. Could you perhaps tell us a bit more about that and when that would be the case?
Yes. Niels, thank you for the question. I was making that statement in the context of the cooperative engagement process under 4.3E. So what happens is when a claimant brings a claim against ICANN under IRP, there is a bylaw saying, look, there is a cooperative engagement process that exists, and you should participate in this, ICANN and claimant. If the claimant does participate in the cooperative engagement process, two things could happen. One is the case could be solved without having to go to the panel, or two, it's not solved, but there was a good faith effort to try and solve it, and that may help the parties in some respect. If it's determined that a party did not act in good faith and did not participate in the CEP, and they lose the case ultimately, there is a provision, and I'll try and find it and put a note in the chat which bylaw it is, that they would potentially be responsible for ICANN's legal fees.
Thanks, David. Jorge Cancio.
Hello. Thank you, Jorge Cancio, Swiss government, for the record. Just very briefly, I saw that you are working on the public comments that were made to the supplemental procedure rules, and I just wanted to put for the record that for some of us who made comments, it is very important that you take the suggestions we made on language interpretation and translation as seriously, as this is a very important element for making this IRP accountability mechanism available for the larger ICANN and global community. So just to say that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jorge. I have read your comments several times about language and translations. I agree that that's an important part of it. And when I mentioned the other four things that we're making progress on now, I didn't mean to give any slight to any other comment that had been made. These are the things that we've just been recently focusing on and that we've had to work hard on. But no, the translations is an important part of it. We haven't decided what's happening there yet, but I take your point, and we've read your comments, and so thank you. Thank you for the comment.
Thanks. David, I closed the queue, Caboose, before you raised your hand, but I'll just ask David to respond to your question if it's the same as in the chat. David, Caboose asked if you could speak about the criteria of those who may be eligible for consideration by the SO and AC. I think for appointment to the standing panel, is that who would be eligible, Caboose?
I think that's what you mean, Caboose, is who...
Yes, we have discussed that, and I hope that you explained that and at least mentioned that it will be in the letter sent to the SO and AC. What
yes.
are the criteria that the people are eligible for consideration at the level of SO and AC before they're making their selection? While I having the floor, for some SO, AC, this is important. They have sufficient time, and in particular, I'm not the speaker for the GAC, but for the GAC, I know while they are in session, they are more active than while they are not in session. Thank you.
Thank you, Kavous. It's a good comment. There are requirements. There are standards for people to be members of the standing panel that Kavous is getting to, and some of the bylaws, and I'll put the bylaws in chat shortly when I get back following this, but things like being an internationally trained lawyer, deep experience, arbitration skills, things along those nature. There are also diversity requirements in selecting the standing panel, and these will be made clear in the expression of interest, and they will be made clear to the SOs and the ACs as they execute their as they discharge their duty in nominating panelists. But the panelists, it's a fairly, the bylaw is looking for fairly experienced, international, arbitration-skilled kinds of people familiar with commercial disputes and alternative dispute resolution.
Great. Thanks. Look, everyone, we've run out of time for this item. The queue has been closed for some time, so I've got to ask that if you have further questions on this, please raise them on the email list or speak with David at the coffee break that's coming up. Thank you for that input. David, would you mind staying at the table for the CEP item, which is right now, if that's okay, since there are some interlinkages? And I'll hand over to Leon Sanchez, who will be chairing the next item on the CEP, the cooperative engagement process, and welcome Ed Morris to the top table for that.
Thank you very much, Jordan. This is Leon Sanchez again, and I'd like to welcome Ed Morris to the table, as he will be providing us with an update on the CEP subgroup. And for that, I would like to turn now to you, Ed, please.
Hi, good morning, everybody. Do we have the slides, or can we get them?
We do have some slides from Ed. So
thank you. What I'd like to do is first thank one of my team members, Anna Loop, who, while I slept last night, made these slides. So we have a very dedicated member in Washington, D.C. At the outset, first I want to thank you for being here this morning. And the purpose of our group coming to the plenary today is a bit different than David's. We need your help. We're a small group, a feisty group, but a very small group. We're on a track for one public comment. We have to get this right. And so we're going to be turning to you for advice in terms of how we proceed in our group. We came to the plenary 4 months ago. We asked you, what do you want the CEP to be? You told us, a form of structured negotiation. We don't want it like it is now, where the parties go into the room with ICANN Legal, with nobody else being there, no transparency. But we also don't want a formal mediation. We want something in between, a structured negotiation. So in our small group, that's what we've been working on. But we've been doing it also with more of an overview of the problem of the current CEP, and I'm going to put Cheryl on the spot. Cheryl's pointed out in our group that the problem with the CEP and how it works today is the same problem with a lot of the accountability mechanisms. There's a lack of trust involved, a lack of trust between the community and ICANN, between legal and staff, between the community and legal, and between the community and staff. And we're not going to solve all those problems with the CEP, but if we do it right, I think we might be able to make some progress through a well-defined set of rules to trying to bring trust back into the process. Next slide, please. Okay, a few of you may not know what the cooperative engagement process is. David did a nice job at trying to explain at least a little bit of it. The CEP is not an independent ADR. It's part of the IRP. It's designed to feed into the IRP, and we can't forget that. In some of the discussions we had early on in the group, folks wanted to turn this into another arbitration, an arbitration before an arbitration. That's not what its purpose is. Under the bylaw, very specific, the CEP is designed to narrow the matters of dispute of a potential IRP or to resolve the dispute. We'll talk a little bit about what we've been discussing in the group about this, but it's important to remember those are the two goals. We also are, can we go to the next slide? I should talk about the financial incentive. As David mentioned earlier, if you don't participate in the CEP, you could get stuck under certain conditions with ICON's legal fees. So there is an economic incentive to participate in the CEP. Pretty much everybody does because of the economic incentive. The major difference in the bylaws between the new CEP under the bylaws that came into effect on October 1st and the old CEP is there's the possibility for provision of a mediator. That wasn't there before. It's there now. But we now need to figure out how to use the mediator within our group. The task for the subgroup is pretty simple. In the bylaws, the community is charged with developing a set of CEP rules. That's our job. Next, please. Oops, slide. Thanks. Okay. So as we set out to do this, we got our small group together, and we started talking about the CEP. One of the problems was in the initial group conversations and calls, we had 5, 6, 7 people. I was the only one who had ever been in a CEP. So it was almost leading the blind, folks that sort of heard things about it but didn't really know what it was. Alan, during our plenary 4 months ago, suggested, hey, you guys need some hard data. Find some hard data. Well, we couldn't because the CEP is completely opaque and non-transparent. There are no transcripts, at least public transcripts. There are no recordings. We didn't know what was going on in the current CEP. So what we as a group decided to do was issue a call to the members of this community, to the SOACs, and ask for folks who had been through a CEP to please talk to us. We also talked to ICANN staff, ICANN legal, ICANN board members. So between March 10th and June 1st, we conducted 11 interviews, fairly in-depth. I want to thank those. Some of you in the room participated in this process. Thank you very much for your time. We found the interviews to be very valuable. It forms the basis of where we're going today and hopefully this discussion. We guaranteed anonymity to everyone involved because, quite frankly, if you're a community member involved in actions with ICANN Legal and you're going to be identified with the comments, you're not going to be that frank. And that was something that was made clear at the start. We had members that would not speak to us until we gave them that guarantee. So I can't tell you where this came from, but there is one thing, one misconception I do want to clear up. In Copenhagen, there was somebody, a member of the CCWG, who was misinformed about the cooperation of ICANN Legal, and at one of the sessions said that they were not cooperating. I want to just dispel that myth. Sam and John obviously are very busy, but they've been very cooperative. We've spoken to them about this. Everything we've asked for, it's taken some time, but we've gotten all the information we need. So I wanted to clear up that miscommunication and misconception. ICANN Legal has been very helpful. Okay, can we go next, please? Okay, these are the issues that we're bringing to the plenary today. And I'm going to talk briefly about one before opening the floor so you guys can lead the conversation into the areas you feel are most relevant. We've been discussing the purpose of the CEP, a change to the structure to have sort of a subversion of the CEP in certain matters. We've spoken about the third-party mediator or neutral party in the room. Timelines, and I'm glad David's here because that's something our groups need to work together on. The transparency and discovery rules. Next slide, please. Okay, so as I said, in the bylaws, there are two purposes. We want to narrow the areas of dispute for potential IRP, or we want to resolve it. Well, something's come up during our interviews that I thought was pretty interesting. First of all, as David mentioned, the IRP may be less expensive than formal legal action, but it's pretty expensive. You know, we've gotten ranges of $500,000 to well over $1 million for past IRPs. That's going to change in the new structure. But we've also lowered the cost of entry to an IRP. So some of the respondents we spoke to said, hey, man, we don't know what's going to happen in future IRPs. We could be flooded with IRPs. We need the CEP to act as a gatekeeper. Now, that's not in the bylaws. Resolving disputes potentially are in the bylaws. So one of the questions we come before you today with is, to what extent, when we fashion the CEP rules, should we focus more on trying to resolve the dispute than in narrowing the issues? Because our understanding from the people we've spoken to who have been in CEPs is right now they principally try to narrow the issues and define the issues for the IRP. So we come before you to say, given the lower cost of entry to the IRP, the expense to the organization, should we be focusing more on trying to use the CEP to settle disputes? Next slide, please. That way, next one. I'm sorry, we skipped over here. Okay. An interesting idea came out of one of our interviews that we then posed to the other interviewees, and that's the following. You go into a CEP, it's ICANN legal versus a claimant who's never been there before. That automatically is creating an adversarial situation. You have legal, then you bring your lawyers in, and as best we can tell, again, the numbers are not available. Best we can tell, we're not getting a lot of resolutions in the CEP. So one idea that we want to bring to you and check in to see how you feel about it is creating, in certain instances, a subversion of the CEP where you have the neutral third party, you bring in the claimant, not the claimant's attorneys, and you bring in the staff members in ICANN who are involved in the issue of dispute. So, for example, let's say the dispute involves GDD. You bring in Akram, you bring in yourself, you have the third party, and you try to keep the lawyers out of it and see if you can mesh a decision and an agreement to avoid the IRP in that fashion. For lack of a better term, we're calling that the small claims version of the CEP as a way of attempting to change the dynamics to bring agreement. So we're going to ask you to comment on that. Next slide, please. Okay, as David mentioned, you're forming a standing committee. And in the bylaws itself, it says that the neutral third party in a CEP should be a member of that standing committee that won't be involved in a future IRP, obviously. Some of our interview subjects have questioned this. The idea is that structured negotiation, I should mention where this term came from. First, I want to thank Greg for bringing this term to my attention. There's a movement in the United States in ADR for something called structured negotiation. And it came out of the disability movement, where you have advocates for the disabled, you have corporations, and the corporations largely want to cooperate with the disabled folks. But when they get into the adversarial situation of implying laws, things weren't working out for anybody. So they brought this concept in a structured negotiation where you have the third-party mediator, and the conversations are designed for two parties to say, hey, we don't want to go further in the legal process. In our instance, we really would prefer the expense and time of an IRP and try to create a mindset that we're trying to work together. So it has been broached to us that the last person you want in the room is a formal mediator, that there are folks out there that engage in structured negotiation. Perhaps we should be bringing them in as the third parties. It's a different skill set. The problem, as I see it, is I believe we'd have to amend the bylaws, and that's something none of us want to do at this point. But it's something we should discuss. Next slide, please. Timelines. As David mentioned, you look at his group, and you guys have spent a lot of time speaking about timelines, statutes. God be with you. It's been an interesting conversation. Well, they haven't considered much the CEP. Let me tell you where the CEP has been in timelines. The shortest CEP that we have a record of, and we only have public record since 2014, was 22 days. The longest CEP was 1,150 days. The average CEP has taken 260, I believe almost 261 days. So as you are starting to create the timelines for an IRP, if you don't build in the CEP, you're going to have some problems. Folks are going to have to choose between filing for an IRP or actually in foregoing the potential financial benefit or a CEP and potentially risk missing the deadline for an IRP. So we're going to have to work together. I'm sure we can craft a solution there. Toll the IRP requirement, I don't know, but we're going to have to work on that. The other question for timeline, which I don't have on the slides, but I thought was quite interesting, speaking to the interview subjects about deadlines. There are many members of this community who said, man, we don't want these formal, hard deadlines because the principal purpose of the CEP in their mind was it slowed everything down, gave a chance for things to settle, for emotions to die down, to be able to actually reach a settlement. On the other hand, there were those who said that the nice folks in ICANN Legal, all they did was try to delay and stall. We need strict deadlines. We have no consensus on the interview subjects, no consensus within our subgroup. We'd really like to hear from you about how we should structure the deadlines internally of the CEP, and David and I and our groups can work together on doing the external deadlines. Next slide, please. Okay. The current, having been through a CEP, one of the things that struck me was you go into a call or go into a room. I don't know if anyone is surreptitiously recording the conversation. I know the one we were in, we didn't. But there's no recording. There's no transcript. Until a few years ago, there was not even notification to the community the CEP existed. There are third-party implications, and we're waiting for David's group to actually finish on third-party involvement in an IRP before we figure out their role in the CEP, because we got to feed into your process. So I presume we're going to pretty much duplicate that. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong. But transparency is an interesting issue, because when we've had some folks saying, hey, open the doors to a CEP, the response to others who have been in, and that would defeat the purpose. The purpose is to be able to go in and frankly speak about the issue. There's third-party interest of matters going out in a CEP. So if an agreement's reached, that agreement, we presume, needs to be made public, but there's no requirement. So we have all these issues regarding transparency, notification. One wonderful interview subject told us, frankly, she was halfway through the CEP and didn't even know she was in a CEP. And so, you know, they get a call. They're in. They theoretically have started the CEP, and this individual did not know that he or she was actually in a CEP, and they were halfway through a one-year process. So we do need to work on transparency at a very minimal level. Right now what ICANN does is they publish a list saying the two parties in the general topic of dispute. I would say that most of us believe there needs to be more. At the same point, how much more? And again, we're going to turn to this group. And one other item we'd like you to weigh in on. We can have the next slide. Do we have, there should be one before there, I would hope, or if not, it doesn't matter. It's discovery. We've had some members, basically from the community, stating the following. The CEP is nothing more than a device by ICANN. I guess it didn't make my apologies, but we're talking discovery. The CEP was established by ICANN Legal to gain an advantage in the IRP, that they use this not to reach agreement, not to narrow issues, but for discovery so they understand what the claimant is going to argue in the IRP. We've had members of the community also who said that ICANN provides no information. They've been in a CEP, yet they have to go through a DIDP to get information relevant to the CEP. So we have this concept of what should we do about discovery. Most agree that the best part of the CEP is it's really informal. They don't want a lot of formality. Yet there's also this lurking issue that feeds into Cheryl's trust question of, if ICANN is perceived as doing nothing more than using the CEP for discovery purposes, if the claimants believe they have to give information to ICANN but are not receiving it, it probably calls for at least some light touch rules of discovery to bring trust back into the equation, or maybe not. And so can we go to the slide that listed all five of the issues, which was at the beginning, because now we're going to open it up for discussion. We need your help, folks. We struggle at times to meet the 5x5. We have been able to do it thanks to the amazing efforts of Bernie to recruit people to our group. And I want to thank Bernie, who's been absolutely amazing in terms of staff support. And I want to thank all the members of the community who participated in the interviews. But now we're looking at this session as an opportunity for all of you to weigh in, to give us guidance, to give us instruction as to how we should proceed, because we're getting to the point where we're going to have to either draft the rules or draft the principles of the rules. So we open up the floor if we could.
Thank you very much, Ed. This is Leon Sanchez. And I see that Cavus has asked a question on the chat, and it is in relation to small claims. He is asking if you could elaborate more on the concept of small claims, Ed.
I'd be glad to. And again, I will tell you my personal opinion, taking off the reporter hat. I have conflicting views about this. I sort of have that law degree, and so as a lawyer, I I don't like having my clients going into a room without me because they tend to say things they shouldn't. At the same point, if we're going to, at the moment, because of the expense of the IRP, the only issues going before an IRP are mega issues that bring in sophisticated parties. Some of the concerns that have been expressed by the interviewees is, since we've lowered the cost barrier, at least at the outset, that we may be expanding the types of issues that are brought before the IRP. And these may be issues that involve staff community problems, relations, that could best be solved not by having John and Amy in the room with the counsel of the other side, or in some ways, as a lawyer, even worse, the other party going into the room without counsel against ICON's legal team. It might be best, Caruso, if in certain instances, which we'll spell out, that you just brought in the ICANN staff member who has, or department that's created the rule or issue at dispute, along with the complainant and the neutral third party, and see if they can work it out among themselves in the CEP without ICANN legal and without their own legal counsel, as a means of using the CEP to settle the dispute before an IRP. The thought being that lawyers tend to be lawyers, tend to make things very legalistic, and at times that augurs against the settlement. Comments? My friend?
Thank you very much, Ed, for this explanation. I have two people on the queue now. I have Sebastian Bachelet and then David McCauley. So, Sebastian, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for this report and interesting. I think when you look to the topic, there are some issues who are dealing with two of our subgroup, and it may be important to raise it now.
Right.
Maybe you can close your microphone because it makes some noise. Thank you. Then, of course, for transparency and the IDPs, and I know that it's also a topic between transparency subgroup and ombuds subgroup. And when you talk about third party, we may rediscuss that after I made the presentation about where we are with the ombuds group, because it could be useful to see if your group is thinking that the ombuds office can do something in this third party or not, and which skill they will have to do if they do it, or if it's outside where it is. I guess to help the group and the co-chair that this will be very important points to cross-check what is going on in various subgroups in specific topics like this one. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sebastian. We have...
Leon, can I just make a quick comment? One thing I want to keep in mind when we talk about the neutral third party of who it may be, in the bylaws, it is required that the party comes from the standing panel. If we want to change that, we really do have to have an amendment to the bylaws. So I want to make sure that it's not something we do lightly, because it's a lot more involved process than simply if we were creating the rules from scratch. I just wanted to make that point. But I take your comments, and we'll talk and we'll try to work together, not only with David's group, but with your group as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ed. I have David, Malcolm, Alan, and after Alan, I'm closing the queue and going back to some questions from Caboose in the chat. So, David, you have the floor.
Thank you, Liam, and thank you, Ed. And I look forward to chatting with you about what you just said. I just wanted to make a comment about the concept of small claims treatment. And it's really just a nomenclature thing right now, because we'll have to discuss that. But the nomenclature bit is small claims. The word small claims, I would hope that we would not use. and early on, because it tends to connote, I think, the idea of money damages. And the IRP process, as you know, really is aimed at getting a decision from a panel, did ICANN or did ICANN not violate the articles or bylaws? And then, assuming if there was a judgment that they did, then it would be over to ICANN to remedy that somehow and remediate whatever that action was. But the IRP is not a place for money damages kind of claims, and so that's why I would personally urge not using the term small claims, but because it may connote something else. Thank you.
Point taken, David. I'm actually going to delegate the job of coming up with a new term to Greg. He's good at stuff like this. So we'll come up with a new term for the concept. Good point, David. Thank you.
Thanks, David. Thanks, Ed. Next on the queue, I have Malcolm Huddy.
Thank you. Good morning, and good morning, everyone. And Ed, thank you for that presentation. When you were discussing the purposes and functions of the CEP, at an earlier point in your presentation, you talked about a function that it has in terms of clarifying the issues for people that might be or will be going into the IRP process. And I can certainly see considerable value in the parties sitting down in a mediated environment where they can thrash out the things that they're not actually in dispute about, where they don't necessarily realize that yet, and to set those things aside so that the only things that need to be litigated in the IRP, if you'll forgive me for using the word litigate for the IRP, but you understand what I mean, is the minimum set of things that they absolutely have to be in dispute about, and that we can actually clear up those things on which there might be confusion when that doesn't need to be brought into the IRP process. That's a valuable thing, but it seems to me that that is likely to be the sort of thing in which somebody might want their lawyer involved. Certainly it seems quite distinct from the second thing that you introduced, which is the idea of a party and a staff member getting together, and actually maybe there's just a misunderstanding here, and if they get together and they talk about it, the whole thing might get cleared up in an entirely mutually amicable way to everyone's satisfaction. That second thing also seems like it might be a valuable thing for the CEP to do, but it's very different to the first thing. And the kind of environment that is likely to bring work, make one work well, is like, in my mind, is likely to be a very different thing to the other one working well. The first one, I think, probably does need the benefit of lawyers, or at least the possibility of the benefit of lawyers. Otherwise, exactly what you said about the problems happen when an unrepresented party goes into the room with a highly sophisticated opponent. On the other hand, having lawyers in, I absolutely take your point that having lawyers in the room in the second example may actually undermine that. It may be just better. And you can certainly imagine that there may be circumstances where a person, an entity that has a problem with what ICANN has done, has not understood what ICANN has done. Maybe because it understands the thing that has happened, but not the other surrounding context. We have a lot of processes which are very specific about its nomenclature, for example, where if you got very upset about something that ICANN did under one heading, and you thought that was wrong because it was excluding one other thing, and you were completely unaware that under another heading, there was something that would have dealt with your problem. And that's the kind of scenario in which actually an amicable discussion would really help. But I would caution you not to conflate those two types of processes in terms of the way that you approach that in terms of implementation. Maybe I don't know how you would separate them, but certainly if you were to say that, you know, lawyers shouldn't be there or something like that, to be able to make sure that it's possible to go into different strands and maybe have both, maybe one after the other sequentially, or all sorts of things. But to understand that they are different functions and that they will need to be treated differently.
Okay, just briefly comment. Yeah, what we realized early on in the interviews is that the bylaws are asking us to do two different things. And in some ways, when you're trying to structure the issues for an IRP, which is what the focus has been to date, folks go into the CEP not really trying to resolve the problem. I think the idea of a two-step process, for example, if we were to go to the structure that we will not call small claims until Greg comes up with our term. We'll just put it that way, perhaps. But then we're running into deadline problems. Because we're all, if you heard those numbers, we're already talking about 80% of a year for the average CEP. And we don't want the CEP running into an IRP for these processes to last many years. And so we have to balance that. But I take your comments. I agree with them. And I think that's something the group's been struggling with. We have these two goals. How do we get both of them into this small process? Thank you, Malcolm.
Thank you very much. Ed, next on the queue, I have Alan Greenberg.
Thank you very much. Alan Greenberg speaking. I had two short points. The first one was the one that David brought up. And although it's conceivable the outcome of any of these processes have monetary involvement, that we shouldn't be flagging it if that's the target. So I agree with what David said. The other one is, Ed, in your presentation at one point, you said to do that would require a bylaw change, and no one wants to do that. We made a vast number of changes in our bylaws, hundreds of pages. There is no possible way we got it all right. I think we really need to have a mindset that says as we discover things that we need changing, either because of the functional changing, we got the function wrong, or we got the wording wrong, we need to keep notebooks, and every few months, let's make the changes that have to be made and accept it as part of the normal course. Otherwise, we're going to be living with stupid mistakes for fear of correcting them or admitting we didn't get it perfect. And there's no possible way we got it perfect. We already know one. You know, what were the AOC reviews where the wording on the documents did not give anyone any flexibility on the timing, and that's what we put in the bylaws. The reality was the board had the ability to talk to the NTIA and change the timing. And we lost that in transition, and we need to be aware of the fact that we didn't do it perfectly, and let's correct it as we go along. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Let me bring that back to the group. I should have stated that we did discuss this in the small group at our last meeting, and no one within the small group felt that we wanted to go through a bylaw change. So that was my misstatement, but I'm going to bring your point back to the group to see what they say now.
Let me be clear. I'm not talking about the specifics in that case. Maybe that was a good judgment. It's just the overall thought processes of let's shy away from bylaw changes with all possible chance. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Thanks, Ed. So now we have some more questions that were left in the chat by Cavus. And the first one is, wouldn't there be a risk if the same people be given two tasks? And also one more question is, what is the kind of input that you're asking from the CCWG app, and on what context, if you may elaborate? So I'll hand it to you.
Let me take the second question first and then ask Cabrus to better explain to me the first question, because I'm not sure I understand it. What we're asking for today is exactly what we're getting. Alan's comment, for example. We'll take that back to the group and say, hey, guys, are we really sure we're not willing to go down the bylaw path? Some of the other comments from Malcolm, the idea that you may want to have a two-step process if you go down to the alternate version of a CEP. That's what we're looking for. We're a very small group, and what I'm really hesitant to do is say, all right, the few of us involved in this process, we're going to make these decisions for the wider community. That's not right. We need your input because we are a small group, and we're getting it today. Some of these comments have been very helpful. So that's what I mean for input. We're looking for guidance. David's group was here to tell you this is what we're doing, this is how we're working on it. What I'm here to do is say, hi, guys, this is what we're talking about. Anything you want to let us know, because there's a lot more of you. There's a lot more experience in the room. We've gone out and we've done the interviews, board members, staff members, community members involved in the CEP, but the general community certainly has an interest in what we do, and we're asking for input today from you in that way. Could you help me with the first question, Cruz?
Thank you. I read it during coffee break. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Cruz.
Thanks, Cavus and Ed. I see one more question from Siva, and this is who would be picking the one member of the panel who would serve as neutral member, whether it be ICANN or the other party yet?
Under the bylaws, the neutral party would come from the standing panel of David of the IRP standing panel, and it would be a party that once you're involved in the CEP, you would not be eligible to serve in the panel for the IRP. The specific way of how it's to be, the individual will be chosen, I guess is something that, again, David and I will have to, in our groups, will have to work on together. Thanks.
Thanks, Ed. So are there any more questions to add on the CEP update and the CEP work group? Okay, so seeing none, we have a scheduled break at 10:15, so that means we are 7 minutes ahead. So let's break.
Okay, one concluding comment, Leon, if I could.
Yes, please.
Could you go to the last slide, whoever's in the slide deck? Very last slide, very, very, very last slide. As I said, we're a small group. I know a lot of you have subgroups that are finishing, and the last thing you might want to do is join another subgroup. We could use your help. We're going to try to start having weekly meetings. Our next two meetings are there, Wednesday, July 12th at 1900, July 19th at 1300. Don't feel that you have a big learning curve. You don't. We'd welcome your input. Secondly, if you think of something and say, hey, I don't want to get involved that much, but I have this point, cepreview@gmail.com. We have our own little email address, cepreview@gmail.com. Send us your thoughts and comments if you want to do it privately, and we'll get it to the group. Thank you very much, everybody. It's been very helpful.
Thank you very much, Ed and David, for being with us at the front table. And now it's time for us to break, and we will be reconvening at 10:30 as scheduled. So let's go to the break. Thanks.
Just a reminder, everyone, this is the 2-minute warning. Thank you.
Can you please be seated? We're going to reconvene very shortly. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, if we could ask you to get your seats, please. We'll be starting momentarily. Thank you.
So can we get the recording restarted, please? So the recording has been restarted, so I'd like to welcome all of you back to the next part of our CCWG face-to-face in Johannesburg. I hope that the remote participants also had some coffee to get some fresh energy to be able to follow the next part of the debate. And what we're now going to hear is an update from the ACSO accountability sub-team. And I'd like to welcome Cheryl, Steve, and Michael to the podium. I'm not sure who of you is going to kick it off. Steve, are you going to take the start?
Or Cheryl.
Cheryl. Over to you, Cheryl, please.
Thank you, Thomas. Cheryl Langdonor for the transcript record. And thank you, everybody, for coming back from your coffee break so very promptly for what we think is an actually very important discussion. And that's what we want today's update from our work group to be. We want it to be a discussion. So we'll be going through a couple of slides and we'll be stopping at most of these slides, posing some questions in a number of them and hoping that you'll be finished with your banking and email updating and interact with us so we can garner your views. Just to be very clear, what we want to do here is look at what came to us as a result of our questionnaire going out to the ACSO leadership. Our report was then generated, modified with our meeting in Copenhagen, and Steve will speak a little more to that in a minute, and then our report was written and that went out to public comment. Those public comments have come in and it's the analysis of that that we want to introduce to you today and to discuss with you, because we kind of thought we knew where we were heading on a few things until we asked the public. Darn democracy. Okay, if we can have the next slide, please. Delighted to report that we had a total of 10 responses received in our public comment period. These are the ICAM board, the at-large advisory committee, security and stability advisory committee, had 4 in from GNSO, business constituency, ISPs, non-commercial stakeholder group and registered stakeholder group, enter, and 2 individuals. And we want to put on the record our thanks to all of those and our intention, as you'll see when we get to the end of today's presentation, to show you all that all of your comments have been duly read, recorded, discussed, and will be responded to. So we are taking all of your input seriously. We're also going to take today's input seriously as well. Let's flip to the next slide, and I think by this stage I'll be ready to have a little drink of water, and Steve will bring you through some background. Over to you, Steve.
Thanks, Cheryl. It's Steve Del Bianco. I wanted to quickly note that Stephanie Ducheno of Google put into the chat, the Adobe chat, an important personal note is that Chuck Gomes is retiring from his position at VeriSign, and this maybe is the last ICANN meeting? Maybe. But that retirement is something that Stephanie was kind enough to put together a card. It's on the back right table, and there's a pen there to sign. Try to come up with some fond memory or funny memory of the past decade and a half with Chuck Gomes, if you can. Thank you. So the background slide that you're looking at sort of summarizes the 3 tracks that we had, and those tracks were laid out in the bylaws. If we go to the next slide, it speaks to what we actually came up with on the track recommendations. And so for purposes of clarification, I wanted to remind you that when we met in March in Copenhagen as a plenary, Cheryl and I and Farzi presented the sub-team's recommendations. Those recommendations were significantly shaped by the plenary in Copenhagen in important ways. We clarified that we're only looking at activities within ICANN, so we're not looking at, for instance, the NRO and IETF outside of ICANN. For best practices, we had quite a debate about what we would recommend on best practices. So instead of saying SOs and ACs should consider, we said they should implement to the extent that the practices are applicable and an improvement on their current processes. And then we also made a suggestion that the ATRT reviews could examine the extent to which best practices had been implemented. These were ways to address the CCWG plenary's concern that our sub-team was not recommending bylaws changes to require SOs and ACs to implement the 25 best practices. And yet, there was a consensus, I think, within the CCWG to make it somewhat more urgent, somewhat more important to consider. And the reason that ATRT was a natural suggestion is that the ATRT is expressly, specifically mentioned in Workstream 2's bylaws, Recommendation 10 and 12, from the report we did in February of 2016. So that report had said we were supposed to look at in Workstream 2 whether the ATRT was an appropriate vehicle for SOAC accountability. You'll see when we review the comments that not many think it's a good idea to burden the ATRT with looking at each and every one of the SOACs and subgroups. And then there was a recommendation of an optional accountability roundtable, which emerged from you in the Copenhagen meeting, as opposed to the sub-team who was not recommending any implementation of a mutual accountability roundtable. We had added examples of reasons to close a meeting to public observation, thanks to Michael for that help, and we had best practices with regard to meeting notes and minutes and the diversity and outreach. And then finally, I wanted to note that when we did the call for public comment on that draft, we included an explanation that a minority of CCWG members prefer that the optional accountability roundtable discussion be expanded to include a mutual accountability. And we don't have to go back through that debate today, but the sub-team did not embrace the notion that ALAC was accountable to GNSO or that GAC was accountable to CCNSO. There wasn't any notion of mutual point-to-point accountability, and that is why we had dropped the word mutual from that concept and say that if there were an accountability roundtable, it would have been an optional process. Let's go to the next slide. We have quickly 6, 7, and 8 slides are just to explore some of the qualified support on track one. Recall the track one is the 25 best practices. If you look in the Adobe, you'll see that I've pasted in a hyperlink to our report and a hyperlink to the actual public comment page, should you wish to follow along there. But with respect to the ATRT, we definitely heard on track one, the first was that we definitely got support on the notion of SOs and ACs are accountable to the groups and individuals that they are created in ICANN bylaws to serve. So they weren't accountable to each other or to some broader public interest, but to the group that they were created to serve. So the qualifications on ATRT, next slide, please. Thank you. The responses diverged, but were certainly more negative about the idea of asking the Accountability and Transparency Review teams, which occur no less frequently than every 5 years, to take on the additional step of examining the extent to which the best practices had been implemented in each of the ACs and SOs and subgroups. So the board in particular was saying that they would not support that and suggested that it be done in the organizational reviews. Now, the organizational reviews is something our sub-team was keenly aware of. It's in Section 4.4 of the ICANN bylaws, and we discussed it extensively as a potential place to do this. But, again, we were following the bylaws charter for Workstream 2, and the bylaws charter for us in Workstream 2 said look at the ATRT. It didn't say look at the organizational reviews. But with the consent of this group, I have a feeling our sub-team will embrace the idea of letting those organizational reviews, which occur no less frequently than once every 5 years, it's a real adventure to go through one. I know ALAC has just been through theirs. And they occur for all SOs and ACs except for the GAC. So that'll be something to note, is that GAC is not one of the SOs and ACs that's subject to the 5-year outside external review. And with respect to GNSO, which has so many subgroups in it, it's a single review of the GNSO that takes a varying level of depth into the underlying subgroups. Next slide. Pick it anytime you wish. There's a track one recommendation on reporting that we wanted to note for all of you. This was something that our sub-team had suggested as another way to emphasize the importance of SOs and ACs adopting some of these best practices. And that would be that each year, every SOAC and subgroup could produce an annual report indicating the extent to which they have improved their accountability, transparency, and participation. I would say that the And subgroup for implementation to the extent that these practices are applicable and an improvement over present activities, present practices. That charter has to survive so that the consultant they hire understands that, whether they're called best practices or not. Alan, you had a follow-up?
Yeah, yes. I'm just suggesting we not pick a term whose formal definition is at odds with the rest of the words you just read.
Thanks, Alan, and we've noted that. Caboose.
Thank you. First, I refer to a need to replace best practice by something else. I don't think that we can find something that really replaces that. Put the best practice in two inverted commas. That is, meaning is known, but it's. I don't think that we can find anything. Go another round of discussion, agreement, disagreement, consensus, and patati patata. So leave it as it is. Someone at this meeting sitting here sometimes ago says that don't make perfection enemy of good. And we want to do that. Or at least we propose to do that. With respect to the question that raised whether we should go to the to another public comment, I don't recommend it as a efficient way, because the scope of the comments, as you have described, authorizes you to modify the recommendation and send the recommendation to appropriate channels to the chartering organization, not to go to the public comments, because you may receive another public comment and you have to go this chain again. So let us be a little bit more efficient. With respect to the comment of the board, I'm sorry, I was not in the room when you mentioned that. If it is possible, quickly mention what was the board comment about this issue. If not, talk it outside the meeting. Thank you.
Might be best to take that outside the meeting, but we'll be happy to do so, Kavis. Next in line is, mine doesn't do it in the right order. I believe it was Sebastian.
Thank you very much, Cheryl. Yes, indeed.
I would like to emphasize the proposal of Alan about getting rid of best practices. I have always struggled in my care life to against that word, because a good practice somewhere is maybe not a good practice somewhere else. Then when we talk about best, it must be the one everybody needs to follow. And for example, if we talk about election process, I'm not talking within ICANN, but in the world, where is the best practices? Which one we need to follow everywhere? And I would like to suggest that we change best practices by good practices. That means that it's a good practice for one group. It may be interesting to look for other groups and become a good practice. But best, it's the only one we can follow. And that's not the case within the organization. The second point I wanted to raise, it's about the board comments. I think we need... I understand the point of view of the co-rapporteur, but before putting that out of the way, I think we need to think about... I know what Alan said about... He will be the representative of at large and the voice of at large. But when they convene as a group, it's also important to take into account the whole community. How we can do that, I have no solution here. But before we say that it's a bad idea, I really think that we need to have some sort, collectively thought about that. And my third point, it's I understand that people doesn't want to give too much additional work to the ATRT. But one important point for the ATRT today, it's to look to the overall organization or to have a systemic view of ICANN. And maybe it could be the good place not to review each SO and AC good practices, but how that fit between the group together. And to give to SO, AC's organizational review one part of the job, is it doing well within this each SO and AC, but taking the cross situation about accountability could be done at the ATRT level. Thank you.
Thank you, Sebastian. Certainly, we will be discussing this more. We certainly would enjoy having more input from this group on each of these issues when we have our meeting. So we'll make sure that our agenda is advertised. So if you wish to join one of our discussion meetings from the work group when particular topics are on, that'll be another opportunity for you as well. Jan.
Yeah. Thank you, Cheryl. Jan Schulte. The question about good practice rather than best practice, maybe I'm slipped through something or dreamt something, but I believe we discussed this last time and that we underlined that good practice would be the better language. Okay, maybe it's my mistake, but it's coming from several quarters now, so if there's general agreement that good practice is better than best practice, we might want to go forward with that. On the reviewing of SONAC accountability, should it be done ATRT? Should it be done in annual reports? Should it be done in the five-year organizational reviews? I guess the decision reflects a little bit what kind of priority you want to put to this issue, how much emphasis you want to give to it. If it's not going to be an ATRT and it's not going to be an annual review and it's going to be the five-year organizational review only, then maybe you want, if it is going to have the kind of priority that you want to attach some language about that it's going to be a thorough and systematic, comprehensive review of the 25 good or best practices or whatever. Anyway, if it becomes a sort of footnote comment, then by the time we come to the organizational reviews, maybe it ends up being one of the, you know, 50 things and it gets just a paragraph. And then what started as, let's make sure we really look at SO and AC accountability,
is not in the ATRT, is not in an annual report, and it's only a footnote in a five-year organizational review, and then I'm not sure you get much organizational learning out of a process like that. I don't have very strong views on the mutual accountability round trade table. I just noticed that it looks like there were five comments supportive and two against, and that doesn't sound like it's an overwhelming voice against the proposal. So maybe you still decide to take it away, but it doesn't sound like the comment you got back was actually telling you to remove it.
We'll have a look at the split in greater details when we come to that next slide again. Avery, I think you're next. Go ahead, Steve. Yeah, sure.
Steve Del Bianco, in the chat, in response to something that Jan mentioned, again, with respect to reviewing the extent to which good practices, best practices have been implemented, the ATRT is no less frequently than every 5 years, Jan, just like the organizational review. So both of those are once every 5 years. I wanted to clarify that. And then I pasted into the chat the section from ICANN's bylaws, which hasn't changed as a result of the transition, section 4.4. And it indicates that the goal of these reviews, which are done of every ACNSO except the GAC, is undertaken pursuant to criterion standards the board directs. So when they direct the review of GNSO, the board is able, through the Organizational Effectiveness Committee, to specify criteria for the review, which I believe is part of the way they solicit the independent expert to do the review. But they only look at a couple of things. They look at whether the organization, SORAC, has a continuing purpose in ICANN. That's an existential question. Two, if it has a continuing purpose, is there any change in structure or operations that was desirable to improve its effectiveness, where the word effectiveness is left to interpretation of the consultants, I'm afraid. And three, whether the AC or SO is accountable to its constituencies, stakeholder groups, organizations, and other stakeholders. And so that's the breadth of it right now. I don't know that has to be changed in the bylaws to accommodate what Jan is mentioning, in that as part of the board's criteria, it would expand the consideration of the implementation of best or good practices. That could be done as part of the criteria that the board gives to the consultants. There may or may not need to be a change to the bylaws, section 4.4. Thank you.
Avery's next, but I'm assuming both Alan and Jan's hands are old hands, or are you coming back fresh? Okay, Alan, you're after Avery then. Avery, go ahead, please.
Thank you. Avery Doria speaking. I just wanted to make two quick comments, one on the nature of best practice. Everybody knows that it's a euphemism for some definition of best, and I guess I'm not at all concerned that we call it best practice, bestest practices, or Fred's practices. But on the cumulative effect, I think, and perhaps I'm misunderstanding the board, or the board is misunderstanding how this multi-stakeholder process is working, is that with each of the stakeholders coming in doing what it is their community wants, and then working together to come up with a cumulative effect, they are actually concerning themselves with the overall community. No one person, no one representative could say, we're here to represent the whole community. That would be nonsense. But when they sit together, each of them arguing what their group sent them there to argue, the net effect should be what is cumulatively best. So perhaps if we can find some language that actually says that that is how that is served, and not by each one being there for all. Thanks.
Aubrey, it's Steve Del Bianco. Thank you for that comment. I think you've given us perhaps a way forward in revising our report in a way that addresses the board's concern. And unless the board comes up with some new mechanism that would suddenly make the five decisional participants accountable to some greater good, we would be able to address it by saying that it's structurally inherent in the five. Think about it. We have the CCNSO, the GNSO, we have governments, through the GAC. We have the numbering organization and the at-large. Those are the current five decisional participants in the empowered community. I think that touches all the bases of anyone on the planet who has an interest in unique names and identifiers. So I don't understand, like you do, I don't understand how you can bring something else into that mix to cover what's not being represented. But thank you.
And back to you, Alan.
Thank you very much. A follow-on comment on that subject. When each of the ACs and SOs makes a decision on acting as an part of the empowered community, and not so much on things like ratifying one of the bylaw we have on the table today, but on the more onerous actions of removing people, rejecting budgets, I think they are each going to do it with a pretty heavy weight on their shoulders as to the impact of what if it's successful, and how is this going to structure and impact the overall ICANN community going forward. And I, yes, each of us have our own axes to grind, but I think there will be a heavy weight and consideration given by the groups of the impact on the community. And each decision, presumably, may, in fact, probably will take that into account. But you can't put the onus on the representative who is bound to act on the instructions of their ACSO. So I think the community has to think about ICANN overall, not only its own little perhaps petty issues, but that's where it sits, with those major parts of the community. And lastly, on Cavus's comment of a footnote defining best practice, in my naive youth, I would, on regular occasion in a document, saying we're using this, at the beginning, as a definition, we're using this term to mean, and then give a non-standard definition. It never works. People ignore it completely and go ahead and presume you're using the standard one. So I would strongly suggest we not do that.
Thank you, Alan. Steve Del Bianco. I will note that the sub-team's recommendations that this group ratified when published it didn't include the best practices in the bylaws and didn't actually say where they would live. And the notion was that it needed to be referenced someplace, whether it was referenced in the ATRT, in the organizational review, perhaps in the standard operating procedures. There need to be some link to it so that those best practices, good practices, are available for people to examine them. So while they might be referenced in the bylaws, there may not be any imperative that they have to be implemented. And yet we still need to provide an organizational link to that document.
Steve, just looking at time, I think we might move to the track two now, don't you? Yep. Okay, let's move down to track two, another couple of slides along. And again, one more. There we go. Okay, so this is where we see what we believe is at least considerable divergence. The split was 3 in support, 2 qualified support, that's absolute middle of the road stuff, 1 concern and 2 clearly against what we had put in our report based on the modifications you asked us to make in Copenhagen. So what we're looking to you for now is feedback on this result from public comment. Lacking, at least in our view, strong support for any mutual aspect of a form of accountability process, even though we had it very much optional and we thought, relatively low key but still urgent enough to meet your views from our last face-to-face meeting. We want to know from you, do we go back to our work group's original recommendation, which was against, without even attempting to recommend an optional exercise. So I've already got a cue on that, and hopefully it's in the right order of Alan, then Malcolm, then Julie. So back to you, Alan.
That is an old hand now.
Let's ignore Alan and go straight to Malcolm. Malcolm.
Well, I spoke in Copenhagen commending you on your original proposal and urging you not to change it. So do I get to just get to say I told you so? Maybe to be slightly more constructive, it's this concept of mutual accountability that I really struggle with. I think that it undermines the accountability of the SOACs to their own constituents. If there is still really a wish in this room, and it's, I guess, based on the process that you reported, it seems to be this room that wants it rather than anyone else, but if there is still a desire for something like this, maybe it should be, we need to change the name. Instead of calling it a mutual accountability roundtable, which triggers all that concern that we're actually being accountable to each other rather than to the people that we were put here to represent, have it as a information sharing, you know, case study example dialogue, an inter-community dialogue, you know, something of that nature that does not imply that the people that are attending it on behalf of their SOACs are in some way responsible to the people at the meeting they're going to rather than to the people that sent them there.
Thank you, Malcolm. Julie. Sorry, Julie. Apparently Steve wants to jump in. Go ahead.
Steve Del Bianco. Thank you for reminding us you want us to stick to our recommendation. But I wanted to clarify that what we put out after discussing this with all of you is what I've just pasted into the chat, and I read it to you earlier. We did not post for public comment in our recommendation calling it Mutual Accountability Roundtable. It was an accountability roundtable. The word mutual was noted on the public comment page as a minority, and I believe only one comment spoke to the mutual aspect of accountability. The comments, other than that, the rest of the comments were about the generic accountability roundtable. And as I've posted here to describe it, it doesn't speak to this mutual. It's really a sharing of best practices, which was part of the way Willie Curry had described an accountability roundtable in 2015 when he first came up with it. But having said that, it already is described the way you were suggesting we describe it, and under that description, not mutual, but just an accountability discussion, under that, it did not receive what we would call substantial support, which would lead us to potentially come back to where you would have wanted us to be when we met in Copenhagen. Thank you.
Now it's Julie's turn.
Thank you. Julie Hammer from ESSAC. I distinctly remember this conversation in Copenhagen because I was going to raise my hand to speak against the Mutual Accountability Roundtable when time pressures precluded further discussion. And I really think that discussion was truncated, and those of us who didn't agree with the suggestion of going back to that recommendation didn't have the opportunity to express that. So I'm not really surprised at all that this has been pushed back in the public comment. I support what Malcolm has said, and add the ESSAC perspective on where we would like to see this suggestion go. We don't support even the concept of the accountability roundtable as this major public forum. We suggest that that could lead to a lot of posturing, which isn't necessarily the most productive way to exchange views. The ESSAC has suggested is that this topic would best be covered in one of the regular chairs meetings where they schedule discussion about what they're doing within their SOs and ACs and share their views and share their practices that are working best for their particular groups. So I'd just like to add that perspective. Thank you.
Thanks, Julie. Jordan.
Thanks, Cheryl. This is definitely not a comment wearing a co-chair hat, but I was one of the people who stuck an oar in on this topic last time we discussed it, so I thought it would be fair enough to make another oar intervention. I think that what this concept got to, in my mind, was similar in some ways to the board's comment on the broader picture here, which is that if we fragment all of our accountability decisions and discussions into the narrow silos of the SOs and ACs, and if we say that the only sort of accountability that those groups have is back to the specific communities that they've been organized around, so CCNSO is an example around the CCTLDs, What we don't want to see in the long run is ICANN being unable to have an ICANN-wide conversation about the organization, being unable to raise any concerns that people might have about specific operations within those SOs and ACs. So if the view of the room is that a specific forum will lead to grandstanding, will lead to the kind of stuff that Julie was just describing, then it probably isn't a helpful innovation. But at the moment, the two sort of collectors that might be able to do this are the SOAC leadership that comes together from time to time and the actual ICANN board. So all of those people have roles that put them in some conflict in reviewing their own practice on the one hand, and on the other hand, they're the leadership of this community and they've got a job to do that should be about considering and being able to gently raise concerns if they see them and share good practice where they see it. So I'm certainly not someone who wants to die in a ditch about the specific recommendation, but I think that we just have to come back to that memory that as well as the linear accountability back to the communities that we have a global accountability as the group running this identifier policy organization to the global internet community that goes beyond the narrow silos of SOs and ACs. And we need to embed and make sure that that question, that topic, is taken account of formally or informally in the various communities that we have within the institution. That's all I wanted to say.
Thank you, Jordan. Steve Del Bianco. One of the things you helped us design over the last 3 years was the escalation process that the empowered community goes through when it's deciding whether to exercise one of the powers of the empowered community. And I believe it was you, Jordan, who wanted to be sure that we had a space to talk, and it was at the Los Angeles meeting we really designed this notion that it would only take one or two of the decisional participants to provoke a community-wide conversation about whether to move to the next stage of escalation, you know, the having of a call and a discussion of whether to exercise a particular power. So I believe that community-wide conversation, which may start from the perspective of a CCNSO or GNSO, but inevitably those conversations have to be with each other, and it's intended through those conference calls and face-to-faces, that that would be done in the context of whether to exercise and how to exercise a community power. That is completely distinct from a notion of whether once a year leaders get together and discuss how's that all going with respect to accountability. So I would submit to you we have delivered the community-wide conversation. It's part of the escalation process that we've all designed and approved for the exercise of the empowered community.
Thanks, Steve. And of course, just to remind you all, our brief to put a term on it, it was to look at who watches the watchers. And I think that's what at least the co-rapporteurs had done their best to keep the work group focused on. I'm just going to make a last call for anybody on this topic after Cavus. Not seeing anyone. You're the last speaker on this. Go ahead, Cavus.
Thank you. I was personally not in favor of this mutual accountability at the beginning, but when I saw that the issue going toward to make it optional, I was changed my mind. I was criticized by one of the co-rapporteurs why I changed my mind, which is not appropriate. I am free, according to the prevailing situation, to come back to the issue and take it differently. However, I suggest that, first of all, we separate publicly or non-publicly from the issue of the optional. We do it step by step, do it optional, and then do it publicly. If it goes well, you decide to do it mandatory and then publicly or not publicly. The problem is that CCWG, from the very beginning, we are just discussing theory. We don't know the practice, how it goes. Let us do it first trial to see whether with optional works. If it works, then do it publicly. And then if it still works, go to the mandatory. Thank you.
Thank you, Cavus. And as ever, your comments have been noted and will be taken into account in our deliberations. And of course, you're part of our work group, so when we discuss these public comments, you'll no doubt be able to make your preference for retaining it, as opposed to what we are suggesting about not retaining an optional. But we've also seen from ESSAC that they've suggested another form that we also need to discuss. Caviezel, I just wanted to make very clear for the record that if at any point you have felt that any of the co-repertors have in any way personally criticised you or been unfair or critical in suggesting that you don't have a right, as everyone does, to re-look at things and to indeed change their mind, because what we're doing is building consensus and having a discussion. We could do 180 turns several times through these processes. I'm going to take it on behalf of all three of us to apologise for that, if that is how you've interpreted anything that is said. But it was certainly, as far as I'm concerned, not the intent to offer any criticism or insult at any point to any of our commenters and indeed our hard-working work group members such as yourself. So with that on the record, hopefully responding to your point. Let's close off on that particular topic and in the last couple of moments look to track three. Next slide, please. I'll toss that to you, Steve.
Thank you, Cheryl. It's Steve Del Bianco. The track three is the use of the IRP. I believe a recommendation was pretty well supported. Do not implement the IRP to challenge an SO and AC. I do think we are going to need to expand the discussion of whether the Ombuds Office would be able to handle this. And at this point, we don't know enough about what the Ombuds Workstream 2 will do, especially given the very, rather extensive external review recommendations that just came in a week or two ago. And so I look forward to that discussion after lunch. Is there anyone who wants to add anything on our Track 3 recommendations at this point? Seeing none.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
We're done.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, Jan Scholte. It's not so much about the track three. It's just a general comment overall. So maybe I should hold off until you're okay for that. No, it's just I'm going back to Frankfurt and the meeting where this first Watch the Watchers came up. And again, the inspiration for this whole SOAC accountability discussion and reflection was the notion that with the IANA stewardship transition, the community, the multi-stakeholder community, as the empowered community, was going to get more power, and that therefore it was right that those who have more power also have more accountability. So we now have the more power in the various transition arrangements. I guess what one would want to do now is look at what is coming out of this discussion on the SOAC accountability and say, does it match up? Do the increases in the accountability of SOs and ACs match up to the increased powers that those SOs and ACs collectively as the empowered community have? And in a way, that's for you to decide. But if it were to be that one emerges with a list of 25 best practices, good practices, whatever they're called, which I suspect once these discussions are finished and once this cross-community working group is disbanded, will not get regular reading attention. If there's going to be an ombuds option to take complaints, and there's going to be a five-yearly organizational review which will look at these issues, but in an undefined and unspecified way on the whole, I just ask you the question, do you think that collectively is enough to match up with the increased power that the community has? Again, remembering here that you're asking to regulate yourselves in this, and nobody is usually running to say, I want to be made more accountable. It's usually outside parties who do that. In this case, you are making these arrangements for yourselves without any particular outside pressure at the moment.
Thank you very much, Sean. We've taken that on board, and of course, this may not be the last attempt at review of these sorts of things as well. We're simply finishing our work practices in a timely manner, we hope. And with that, Steve, do you have anything to close, or we throw back to the co-chairs? Thank you. We're done.
Thanks so much. I think with that we can end this part of the agenda and move to transparency, which is going to be chaired by Leon.
Thank you very much, Thomas. And so we have an update on the transparency group, and for that we have here our colleague. So please do take the floor.
Thank you. I see that I've been granted the coveted time slot right before lunch, and I do understand the weighty responsibility that that entails to make sure that we finish on time. I will also say, though, that I've spoken with our hosts and have agreed that until we reach consensus on the issues under discussion, nobody eats. So with that said, on that note, just a quick update on the status of the transparency group to start. You may notice that I'm flying solo up here, and that's because my co-rapporteur, Chris Wilson, is stepping away from ICANN, has stepped away from ICANN. So I'm now the only rapporteur of the subgroup. I do want to mention briefly that Chris was taking the lead on recommendations for transparency on interactions with governments. And he...
Sorry to interrupt you. I didn't introduce you by name, so for transcript purposes, this is Michael Karanikolas speaking.
Yes. So he drafted some responses before he left to the feedback that we got in terms of the consultation. But we haven't done more than that in terms of taking that section forward. If there is anyone who's interested in taking the lead on that section, that would be very welcome. Otherwise, I will be taking that on myself, but any assistance would be very much appreciated if anybody has a particular interest in transparency and interactions with governments and wants to join us for the home stretch. The main thing that we're going to be talking about today is the DIDP section, which has attracted the most energetic debate. There's been a revised draft of the report circulated, and that includes some minor changes to the document to accommodate what we see as the non-controversial inputs. Basically, mostly just clarification and slight linguistic tweaks to clarify certain issues. And I'll also mention that since the last meeting, I followed up with a conversation with Samantha Eisner at ICANN Legal, who's been very positive in dealing with some of the thornier issues under discussion, and specifically around the duty to document, which she was very positive about. So there is a back and forth going on that front, which should also help to hash out some of some of these issues. With that being said, there are two main issues that I was hoping to open up for discussion here today that have proven particularly controversial, and so I think I was hoping to use this opportunity in order to try to push forward and clarify some of the contrasting positions and to find out what the plenary thinks. And the first of these is transparency at ICANN Legal and how we should treat attorney-client privilege in the DIDP. The current recommendation is to say that the DIDP exception for attorney-client privilege should be narrowed so that only information will only be withheld if its disclosure would be harmful to an ongoing or contemplated lawsuit or negotiation, and mandate the disclosure of broader policymaking advice received from lawyers. So this would replace the current class exception for anything subject to attorney-client privilege to a more specific exception related to litigation, negotiations, et cetera. That's the recommendation as it currently stands, and there were some concerns raised within the consultation, including by ICANN, but also by other stakeholder groups that were concerned about that this would impair the efficacy of ICANN Legal to do their job and that this would potentially be harmful to ICANN Legal's broader ability to act as legal representation. So we've sent around a little bit of background research that I asked for related to this. You'll see there that limitations, if some of you have taken a look at it, limitations on attorney-client privilege are fairly common across the public sector, because otherwise it's a fairly easy way to avoid transparency rules if you don't have those kinds of limitations. We've seen governments that are subject to transparency rules try to avoid that just by bringing a lawyer into the room. So we're trying to avoid that in the recommendations by narrowing that, but at the same time, there were concerns raised. And I'll also mention that attorney-client privilege is always waived at the discretion of the client, namely ICANN here. So we are free to set our own policies about this. But the main question that I was hoping to discuss here is what people's thoughts are on transparency and ICANN legal, how that should be taken forward. The specific ask that I got from Samantha Eisner in discussing this was a little more specificity on what does the community want to see in terms of enhancing transparency. Are there specific categories of information or types of information that we want to see put out there? Do we see a need for more transparency at ICANN legal or not? Do we like the current recommendation? Do we want to push it to a different standard? And with as much specificity as possible, if anybody has clear thoughts about what kind of information we want to see made more available, that would be very much appreciated. The second area that I was hoping to open up for discussion involves the exception for commercial information. In terms of commercial speech, the recommendation in the current report says that the exceptions for trade secrets and commercial and financial information not publicly disclosed by ICANN and for confidential business information and or internal policies and procedures should be replaced with an exception for material whose disclosure would materially harm ICANN's financial or business interests or the commercial interests of its stakeholders who have those interests. Now, we had some energetic debates about this within the working group and also in the consultation. There were strong objections raised by a few different stakeholders, by a few different submissions, since this shift in the language of the exception would place decisions around disclosure in the hands of ICANN, regardless of any NDA or assurances that were made to the third parties that provided that commercial information. Obviously, there are legitimate commercial interests which need to be respected, and commercial parties that engage with ICANN and provide material which is sensitive need the assurance that that information will be properly safeguarded. At the same time, it's a similar concern as with the attorney-client privilege, where if we structure a system where ICANN can just choose to classify information whenever it wants through an NDA, that again is a fairly easy loophole to the DIDP policy. So we've discussed different avenues forward. One potential solution would be to clarify the rules around how NDAs are used and to sort of restrict when they're in place going forward so that they would only be signed where there's commercially sensitive information, where that information needs to be withheld, and that if NDAs were only applied in narrow and limited circumstances, then that would limit concerns around providing a clear carve-out for NDAs. And that relates a little bit to the discussion about open contracting that was mentioned, that's also part of the recommendations, and that we're also kind of hoping to talk about as part of this, whereby clear rules around contracting could help to advance, help to clear out concerns around the commercial speech exception. So again, we heard that people want more transparency built into these processes. We heard support for open contracting and support for greater transparency, but we also heard significant concerns, particularly around the need to respect NDAs and concerns around weakening and placing into ICANN's hands more flexibility to disclose that information. So with that being said, I was hoping to open it up to discussion on those two issues. One is attitudes towards attorney-client privilege and enhancing transparency at ICANN legal, and the second is approaches to commercial speech. The exception for commercial information, rather, not commercial speech, and how that should be understood, as well as how that interacts with open contracting and non-disclosure agreements. So having teed up those areas for discussion, I'd like to open it up and hopefully get some feedback on what people think.
Thank you very much for this update and this insight, Mike. So now the floor is open for comments. Obviously, the subgroup is seeking for your thoughts and your opinions on these two issues. So I see that there is a hand up. That is David, and Kavus has also posted a question on the chat. So I'll go with David, then I'll read Kavus' question, and then I'll go to Greg. So, David, you have the floor.
Thank you, Leon. David McCauley for the record. Thank you, Michael. And I'm sure this won't come as a surprise to you that in the subgroup, I have been one of those who has been on the other side on both of those issues, attorney-client privilege and non-disclosure agreements. And so my comment is in two parts. First is a question, and the second is just so that the plenary hears it, just the concerns I had. The question is, and then I'll go ahead and state my concerns and you can answer the question, but the question is, it's my understanding that even though we have received some comments from ICANN, is that there are additional comments being worked on by ICANN Legal, and that we're expecting the delivery of some additional comments. And I think some of my concerns may melt away if, in fact, ICANN Legal doesn't have those concerns. And so I'm operating under the assumption that there is some more information coming our way from ICANN, and pending that, I think that's important stuff that we'll have to take into account. The concerns I have on attorney-client privilege are strictly that it's a widely recognized privilege, and clients, organizations need to be able to speak freely with their counsel and get counsel. And if we somehow diminish that, then we may have we may be reaping unintended consequences where people create workarounds, and that is simply not discussing issues and somehow freezing or limiting the way they operate. And I think it could be harmful. I think that attorney-client privilege is widely recognized and should be observed. And the second concern I had was with respect to non-disclosure agreements. I personally feel, and I think it is reasonable to believe, that non-disclosure agreements that are appropriately entered into would be observed, and that any decision to make an exception and to disclose commercially valuable information would have to be made by the person that owns that commercially valuable information and not necessarily by ICANN. I think if there is an exception where something may be disclosed, ICANN should not be in the position of making a decision for someone whose information it has been given a confidential handling for. And so those are the concerns. I may change the concerns a little bit depending on what ICANN says. I doubt that I will on non-disclosure agreements, but I think they're important principles that we need to maintain. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Mike, would you like to answer?
Yeah, thanks for that. Just to quickly respond to what you mentioned about in terms of what we're waiting for, to your question about what we're waiting for in terms of ICANN Legal. Yeah, so essentially I had a conversation with Samantha Eisner, and we agreed that there was some information, additional information that I would provide to her, and there was some information that we would get back from ICANN Legal. So in the aftermath of that, I sent around a little more background information on how the duty to document works in practice, which was a major area that she wanted more information on. As I said, she was generally positive towards it, but just wanted more clarification. And then the second one was about clarifying what information do people want from ICANN Legal? And that's one of the things that I was hoping to discuss here. In terms of what we're waiting for from them, mostly it's around attorney-client privilege. And they said that they would look more and provide a little more detail about their different practice areas, about the duality of that role between the policymaking and the litigation negotiation function, which was at the core of the recommendation as it's currently phrased, to try to hash out with a little more specificity how we can provide more transparency into the former in terms of that policymaking function and provide the proper safeguards to the latter in terms of litigation and negotiations. So we are waiting for more information, and I do see this as kind of a back and forth that is happening in terms of ICANN legal with regard to the attorney-client privilege question and to the duty to document question.
Thanks, Mike. So I just want to ask, Cavus, has your question been answered by Mike? I know that you have another question on the chat, and it reads, Leon, please also ask Michael what he expects from us in determining what document to be available. This should have been advised by the group and not coming to us to start. So that's what Cavus is mentioning. Do you want to answer to that, Mike?
Sure. So the DIDP more broadly is essentially about drawing a line through the organization and saying, here's what's available for disclosure and here's what's subject to classification, generally. This is the broad mission of the subgroup, is to examine where this line should be and provide recommendations on what should be available and what shouldn't. Now, if you look at the recommendations that we've arrived at thus far, there's been a lot of clarification suggested as to how that line should be drawn and where the and how the current exceptions should be tweaked to respect that. Currently, the discussion that we're having now is not as much about a wide-ranging sort of broad discussion about where the totality of that line should be drawn, if that makes sense, and more about two specific exceptions or three specific exceptions within the current policy for attorney-client privilege and with regards to third-party commercial information. So we're hoping to foster debate just on those issues at the moment and understanding how confidentiality should work with respect to those.
Thanks, Mike. Next on the queue, I have Greg Shatton.
Thanks, Greg Shatton, for the record. First, wanted to point out that the IPC submitted comments which were expressed, you know, significant concerns on the issues that you raised here. Not going to, you know, rehash those, but I do personally, not speaking for the IPC, agree with the concerns that David raised, although, you know, hoping for more disclosure, but you know, just blowing up attorney-client privilege, you know, is a dangerous thing. But agree that the opacity of ICANN legal is something that we need to change institutionally as well. Obviously, it's a sensitive issue and needs to be dealt with. And I agree with characterizing it as a continuing conversation. Specifically on the point of open contracting, it was the IPC's position that Recommendation 16 should not be adopted, and that, first off, it really goes beyond the scope of the DIDP to even make this recommendation, and beyond the scope of the transparency efforts for which the subgroup was chartered. Now, open contracting is a specific concept, as I understand it, a movement that really applies to government contracting and the idea of giving citizens insight into government contracting practices, and that it involves a number of practices and procedures throughout the contracting process that some may and some may not be appropriate for ICANN, some may be appropriate with amendments, but the idea of actually adopting open contracting per se is a bad idea. And it really needs to be considered separately and carefully and not bootstrapped to recommendations on the DIDP. You know, ICANN's contracting practices could certainly use some examination, but the idea of just trying to fit the shoe of open contracting over the foot of ICANN contracting seems like a bad fit to me, and we'll just end up with bunions and blisters. So, as a general matter, I personally and IPC generally, encouraged ICANN to consider ways to contract in a way that allows for maximum disclosure or disclosability during a DIDP. But open contracting isn't the way to get there. And finally, open contracting requires that your counterparties agree to open contracting. And so it's really, I think, inappropriate to limit ICANN's contracting parties only to those who would agree to open contracting procedures. So just want to raise, substantial concerns I have with open contracting, which is not mean that we can't have more openness in contracting, but open contracting with a capital O and a capital C just does not fit. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. Any reactions, Mike?
Yeah, sure. So just in terms of the idea of, I guess I would dispute the characterization that we're looking to blow up attorney-client privilege. I probably wouldn't characterize it that way myself. I think we're looking to clarify and limit its applicability. This has been done, as I've mentioned, widely across the public sector in a lot of different jurisdictions. The chilling effect that we've heard about generally isn't seen. Government lawyers are able to operate. But I also want to mention that this has been raised a couple of times in terms of, well, this is something that's done by governments, but it's only done by governments. That's not specifically true in terms of open contracting. You can look at international financial institutions like the World Bank that have taken a more progressive attitude towards this kind of stuff. But more generally, I want to say that in terms of access to information and creating a disclosure policy like this, the vast majority of places that this is done is in governments. It's, as part of this conversation, we've heard quite a bit that ICANN is a California corporation, but if we're applying the same standards of transparency to ICANN that we would apply to Airbnb or Facebook, I mean, we're not going to get anywhere. This whole conversation is predicated on an expansive understanding of transparency. And in order to do that, the standards that we have to look for, the only places where these effective transparency systems are in place, apart from a few international financial institutions, a few intergovernmental organizations like UN bodies, generally the standards come from governments because that's where you have decades of experience in doing this kind of stuff. So while I understand that it's not, ICANN is obviously not a government, but if you want a robust transparency system, governments are the place to find those standards. In terms of the whether or not we should be discussing open contracting, this is something that was raised by first in Hyderabad by participants who wanted to see this kind of stuff, and has been specifically taken up and offer and supported by feedback that we've gotten. I don't agree that this is beyond the scope of the current subgroup, specifically because the NDAs themselves, as I mentioned, the point of the DIDP is to draw that line between what should be disclosed and what shouldn't be disclosed. And if you have these NDAs that are essentially a carve-out and saying this stuff is not subject to disclosure, then there has to be discussion of when they're used. Otherwise, it could potentially subvert the entire functionality of the DIDP. So I would be in favor of addressing this issue, of discussing it. I'm not sure about the distinction between capital O, capital C, open contracting, and opening up contracting, which we've heard about. I would be interested in hearing more about how you would propose, if you have ideas about opening up contracting without the capital O, capital C that you mentioned. And I'd also be very interested because, again, you mentioned you don't want to blow up attorney-client privilege. Okay, I agree with you there. But if you have a problem but you've also mentioned about creating more openness around ICANN legal, which I think is very specifically what we're looking for today is suggestions. How can we, if the current recommendation is problematic, what steps should we take in order to provide more openness? What would you like to see on that front?
I'll respond briefly, Greg Shatton, again, for the record, but I'll have to give more thought in terms of some recommendations. But I will say that with regard to open contracting, first, I don't remember which participants brought it up in Hyderabad, but I don't remember being too many of them. And I remember a discussion, a number of people bringing up concerns with it. So it's a slender reed upon which we get to bringing open contracting in here. And open contracting as such, is a series of recommendations and best practices which kind of come in a package. That's why I want to get away from using that term, because it implies that, we're talking about that package. Yeah, so it's not a good fit. We can talk in a granular fashion about ways to improve the ICANN contracting process to be more open and transparent, but I think this is just the beginning of that conversation. And so I didn't expect you to agree that it was out of scope, clearly not at this point, but I haven't been persuaded that it's in scope either, so we'll have to disagree on that point. In order to be productive, I'll see what I can think of in terms of ways to deal with respecting attorney-client privilege and at the same time, gaining greater transparency into ICANN, the legal advice that ICANN relies on and that the community is expected to rely on as well. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. So next on the queue, I have Cavus.
Thank you again. I listened carefully with the previous presentation. The questions that they wanted that be reflected or answered by CCWG was quite clear, but I'm not sure that what are your specific questions to this group? What do you expect from us? What do you need to have answered? You just opened your document. I have seen that. Thank you very much. But still, I don't know what are the questions that you're seeking advice or views from the CCWG. In previous presentation, we have that one. For instance, they said that if they modify the recommendation, should they get a public comment or not? The answer was yes or no. But still with yours, we don't know. What are your questions, please? Thank you.
Thanks, Caboose. Mike?
Okay, so in terms of the specific questions that we're looking for, one of them is around attorney-client privilege. So the question is, should there be modification of attorney-client privilege as it applies to ICANN Legal? And if so, what modifications do we want to see? That's question number one. And then question number two would be, should there be modification of the standards around third-party commercial information? And for that as well, what do we want to see? So those are the two questions that I'm bringing towards the working group.
Thanks, Mike. So I see two more hands, Thomas and Phil Corwin, so I'll go to Thomas.
Thanks very much, Leon, and thanks, Michael, for your summary and presentation. I have a question for you, and that is, I think ICANN Legal, in the very early days of this discussion, has said that they might have difficulties finding lawyers working with them if we did open contracting. And if we've dumped, untechnically speaking, open contracting on them, that might lead to higher fees for legal consultancy. So I was wondering whether you had any information on that. And the second part of the question would be, having heard the concerns by Greg and others, is the subgroup still aligned that they want to go for open contracting, or would it potentially be valuable to inform the plenary to get somebody from ICANN Legal to talk about the day-to-day handling of cases so that we don't talk about what they're doing, but that we actually try to understand better how their day-to-day operations work and to what extent open contracting would affect what they're doing in order to actually prevent ICANN from being destabilized?
Thanks, Thomas. Mike?
So ICANN Legal, or ICANN generally in their submission, did mention that. I don't think they mentioned it specifically about, in terms of open contracting, I don't think they specifically pointed to difficulty retaining lawyers around that, but they generally mentioned challenges around, that it would raise challenges to the contracting process, which again is something that I've heard a lot of times before from governments, before it was raised, before these policies are put in place, after they're put in place, generally it works out all right. But we did indeed hear those kinds of concerns raised broadly about open contracting, and there's more of a back and forth that's happening with ICANN Legal at the moment about what their concerns are and how more openness could be brought into the process in a way that doesn't, that helps to alleviate those concerns. Again, I'm not, in terms of the difference between the capital O and the capital C and opening up contracting, I think that what we're looking for is avenues forward which will provide more openness, which will provide better transparency and accountability, and which won't compromise ICANN's ability to secure contracts at a competitive cost, as well as to find people willing to work with them. So I'm not sure that I would necessarily draw a specific connection between that issue and finding lawyers directly, but that's probably one of the, that's going to be among the issues that are there.
Just a very brief follow-up. You were now referring to ways you're discussing with ICANN to bring more transparency to the contracting process. So does that mean that you're pretty much aligned with Greg to drop the capital O and capital C, or is the pure open contracting concept still in the mix?
Greg and I agree on everything.
Do you? Oh, that's awesome.
we're going for drinks after this.
I'll agree on the drinks.
I personally wouldn't. I'm going back to the recommendations now to see if there's. For the record, it's not capitalized in the recommendations. But like I don't necessarily associate open contracting as being this very specific and precisely laid out cookie cutter solution. So in that sense, like I would, in terms of, I agree that a specific solution needs to be found for ICANN, which works for ICANN, and wouldn't necessarily advocate for imposing the same solution in every different institution. So from that perspective, like, I think we are in agreement in the sense that, like, I'm trying to bring openness to it without, if that capital O, capital C has a specific negative connotation or is somehow problematic, like, that's not what I was trying to advocate for, but rather I am indeed looking for ways to provide more openness, And so if you look at the specific language of the recommendation, as it says now, what that says is that all contracts above $5,000 are automatically disclosed, and non-disclosure clauses are limited in their application to the legitimate exceptions found in the DIDP. I'm not sure if that's that capital O, capital C thing, but that's the specificity of the recommendation as it currently stands.
Thanks, Mike. Next on the queue, I have Phil Corwin. Phil?
Yes, thank you. Phil Corwin for the record. Speaking solely in a personal capacity, and admittedly, this is not an issue I've been following closely, and my thoughts are if all the terms of contracts above 5,000 are going to be disclosed publicly, that would alleviate any personal concerns I might have. Beyond that, I would say that the need for transparency, in my mind, is more necessary for unique contracts that were not put out for public bid but sole sourced than for the standard contracted party contracts. The registry contract renewals are all put out. They're either a standard contract or they're all put out for public comment on renewal. The registrars, if they're signing a standard contract and renewal, not a big deal. My personal concern would be more with the sole source service provider contract for unique functions, particularly if there hasn't been a public bidding process with these contractor selected on some combination of best bid and best ability to provide services. So I don't know if that's helpful, but I think we don't have to be revealing all confidential discussions leading to every contract, but that there should be some heightened degree of transparency for the unique contracts. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Phil. Any reactions, Mike?
No, that's a very valuable input. That kind of distinction is very interesting. So thanks very much for that. I think that's a very that's a valuable way of differentiating between areas where more transparency might be needed.
Thank you, Mike. Cavus, is that an all hand? It's an all hand. Okay, perfect. So having no more questions, we thank you all for your guidance and your insights. And it's now time for our lunch break. We are ahead of time, 30 minutes almost. And, well, we invite you to have lunch. I was just asked to remind everyone that lunch is served for members of the CCWG and participants. So those people in the room that are not members or participants will have to go and look for lunch elsewhere. So we'll reconvene at 1:30 as scheduled, and let's enjoy lunch. Thanks.